Very well.
Yes.
Thank you, Senator Pappas, and your committee for coming to the joint hearing today. And we have Mr. Claypatch first on the agenda. And I recall all the red shirts from last year, too. Mr. Claypatch, are you trying to find work for all these IBW members here?
Mr. Chairman, any work would be greatly appreciated by probably 95% of the people in this room.
We got to shepherd that the bonding bill through then, and we already got the transportation bill, so I'm sure your members are at least somewhat supportive of that. Mr. Claypatch, then welcome to the committee, and go ahead.
Well, thank you very much. Again, my name, Mr. Chairman, is Steve Claypatch. I'm very honored to be the business manager of IBW Local Union 292 in Minneapolis, and I'm speaking on behalf of all the construction electrician locals in the state of Minnesota, and there's five of them. All the business managers are in the room today, except for one is sick. And I'll be speaking on an issue that we talked about last year, and it's an issue that I think is persistent. And I think as I exited the committee last year, I talked about an analogy, and the analogy was because of the size of Minsky and the oversupplying of electrical workers, look at Minsky and addressing this issue. And I said it's kind of like being a leaf in a swimming pool that every fall they skim off and we never get anything done to address the issue, and it's persisting. I'm very biased, everybody understands my union background, and these people in this room are union members and unemployed, and they'd love to be working and contributing to the income shortfall in the revenue supply of over $330 million, which was announced a couple weeks ago. So real quickly, if you just take a look at the screen, what I will do is follow up with just a quick PowerPoint presentation. I'll email all the committee members from both the House and the Senate a summary of my comments. And as you can see on the screen, these are by cities, by local unions. Total unemployment of the figures on the left are construction electricians with licenses, journeymen, and the people that are wanting to learn the trade are on the right. You can see that there's 1,300 members across the state of Minnesota. Some of them are working outstate, taking their revenue and keeping it outstate Minnesota. They would love to be working in the state of Minnesota. And we have over 20%, rough estimate, but it's definitely 20% and over, which is higher than all unemployment rates across most industries in the state of Minnesota. So thank you all for allowing me to present. Thank you for the bonding bill. Hopefully it'll pass. Thank you for the transportation bill and the courage that was needed. Those will all supply jobs. But there is no magic number, but we can tell you right now, and I'll go over the same figures that we did last year just as a reiteration of our comments last year on what the system is doing in oversupplying an industry that has severe unemployment and the effect it has on the state of Minnesota. Dan? Simple title. Again, in 2007, we did this same presentation, and some of the points that we made were the following. Minsky's training at a rate of 319% higher than any construction trade in the state of Minnesota. What that means is there's more graduates in the construction electrician program than any other part of the construction trade. The question I asked last year was, why are we overtraining electricians when there's more other trades that need people and they're not training at all for those industries? The number of Minnesota electrician graduates is 464% above the national average. These are numbers that we've used. We're not making them up. They come from BLS, Bureau of Labor Statistics, BEAD, Unemployment Insurance, and Minsky's numbers itself. 47% of the graduates from Minsky's trade programs are from a construction electrician program, meaning all the construction programs that are out there for the entire industry, all the graduates, or the 47% of them come out of the electrical program, while electricians only count for 9% of the construction workers on any job. In a five-year period, the 2001 to 2006, they graduated 2,780 people compared to 10,700 employed electricians, or actually 10,700 was the state number of people that were employed. He graduated 2,786, so they basically it's a replacement rate of 26%. More electricians, 27% of them have filed unemployment claims per year for the period of 2003-2005. Same SIC group, carpenters, 16%, Plumbers 16%. Minnesota deed numbers further show that during the same period, 25% of the electricians who filed for unemployment exhausted their benefits, which means that they've been unemployed for 6 months or more. A quick show of hands in the room will show you that the people in this room, raise your hand if you've been out of work for 6 months or more. Minnesota taxpayers' investment in the education, this is the cost the taxpayers have for those same years to train these individuals, of $12.6 million. The return on the investment in terms of the amount of unemployment benefits, electricians drew $47 million in unemployment benefits. So, state of Minnesota taxpayers cost $12 million to educate the people, to educate students, and then unemployment also indicates that there was $47 million of unemployment benefits that were drawn by unemployed electricians. Some aren't even on the rolls anymore. So if you add those together, you got a almost a $60 million drain on the system. So last year, as we brought this forward to Minshew in good faith negotiations, they readily admitted. In front of you, you have a letter from Manuel Lopez, representing the chancellor. In that letter that they said, they readily admitted that they oversupplied the industry by 612 electricians for that period. So that's yours to keep. Since then, the letter also indicated that the Minshew would stop enrollment at the levels that they had, previous levels of 2006 and 2007. Our argument this year is that's where it stopped. We don't have any further progress. Minshew's numbers still are frozen at the same levels that have exacerbated this problem. And the numbers that we don't see any reduction in people that are that are graduating from the program. Do you know my Senator Pappas?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kraypatch, on number two on the letter says that the programs have to start reducing their enrollment targets.
Yeah, I think Senator Pappas. We tried to get the figures. We haven't been able to because the 2007 figures aren't out by Minshew already. I think that what we're seeing and what we're hearing is one program, one class was stopped, and that was in the Hibbing School from everything that we know. We do have people that sit on all the advisory boards that come from the electrical industry and relay the information back. I'm not saying that's factual. I'm saying we did all due diligence to get the information about enrollment figures, and we weren't successful. But we do have firsthand knowledge that they did roll back one class of approximately 30 people in Hibbing. With me today is, my bias. You know I've been here before. And so I thought I'd bring a business person to help understand the issue from the business side. And so with honor, I'd like to, and the chair's permission, introduce Bruce Peterson. Bruce is the owner of Hutch Electric in Hutchinson, Minnesota.
Mr. Peterson, welcome to the committee. And you can go ahead, just identify yourself for the case.
My name is Bruce Peterson. I own Hutch Electric in Hutchinson, Minnesota, very small non-union electrical contracting company. I've had my electrical licenses in the state of Minnesota for around 30 years. And I just would like to shed a little light on what I've seen happening from the non-union side, recently. I used to work in a school setting, too, and I always worked with kids on careers, and we always try to identify, or it's important that when you're going to go into something post-secondary, you should go into something that hopefully when you get done, you're going to have a pretty good demand for employment, and along with that, you'll have a pretty good lifestyle, pretty good income. As an employer, what I've seen the last 5 years, in the spring, I have had a huge amount of people graduating from post-secondary schools, coming to my business looking for employment. I get letters of applications, I get phone calls, I get people walking in the door. For a small company, I've had as many as 30, 40, 50 people looking for work, and not only when schools graduate, but they'll come in other times of the year. Excuse me. It doesn't take a person too long to realize that there's probably a pretty good surplus of workers in the field when that happens. And
we've all got the cough. There's some cases. Somebody get Mr. Peterson some water.
Yeah, we got some water. But I
give him the St. Paul water and he's from Hutchinson.
I've had You know, if they come in the door personally, I'll take some time and talk to them. I'll ask them how many places they've applied for work. And some of these kids have applied, I'll call them kids, but they're graduates of schools, have applied 50, 60, 70 different places. And I'm amazed that that's happening. And I'll ask them what kind of results they're getting, and the results are not real good. I mean, they are out there looking for work. It's my opinion, and I've talked to a number of these people that maybe a year down the road never did find employment in electrical occupations. You know, if you think about it, these people are going to school for 2 years. They're spending $10,000, $11,000 plus living expenses, plus 2 years of their life to become an electrician or getting to that type of occupation. And you would hope when they get done that they're going to have some decent results. And I don't see this happening. This is my opinion, but I don't see it happening. I think there's a lot of people out there that have made the investment and are not finding work. I know the economy is not real good right now, but as an employer, as a small business person, I have seen this thing just deteriorate in the last 5 years. I have rolled back my labor rates. My adding on material to get work, you still can't get work out there. It's extremely tough out there right now. If you bid 20 jobs, you'd be lucky to get one of them. So, you know, it's really tough out there. I think, you know, where does this all lead with people going to school? You know, number one, the onus is really on the kids. They've got to look at what they're going to go into and decide if that's what they want to do, if it's going to be a good career that's going to give them employability when they get done. But I think probably the schools need to be maybe a little bit more upfront also in presenting an accurate, realistic picture on what type of employment people are going to find when they get done. And I think that's an issue right now. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Klapac, do you want to wrap it up?
Yeah, I would, and we'll try to, if there is a second, we'd love to take a question if there's possibly, but very frankly, just because you educate an individual doesn't create a job for them. Minsky should be applauded in the areas that they're successful in following a cycle of needed employment and training that fits it. But in this industry and in others, this committee especially probably hears it more times than not. We're short in this industry. We're excess in this industry. How come they haven't trained in this industry? I would say that there's probably a problem with the cycles and how to fetch the information. And I took the time to contact all the colleges for their paperwork that they send out for construction electricians, you know, just suppliers. And every one of them says, or a good portion of them say, we use Bureau of Labor Statistics, the national statistics. Sorry, it doesn't fit Minnesota right now. Somehow, the Minsky system's got to get itself aligned with what industries are succeeding in this state and what aren't. And there's ways of doing it. I'd love to chat with everybody here. I'd love to field a question in regards to it. But until they do, we're going to have a cyclical industry in the construction, obviously. But how do you find the peaks and valleys and do it for straight across the board? Nurses, another example. Welders, you've heard it enough. How do we do it? These people in this room are being hurt by a system that is flawed because it doesn't follow a cycle. And I'd ask this committee to pay particular attention to it again. And I know you do. Thank you very much for your service. But those men and women in this room really need an opportunity to be able to compete and practice the vocation, which they spent 2 years trying to find also, plus programs for apprenticeship, which we're proud of also. But with that, Mr. Chairman, thanks for your indulgence today. Thanks to my colleague, Bruce, for testifying. We'd be happy to take any questions.
Representative Gattenmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Claypatch, does this issue, does it affect all areas, electricians, linemen? Does it affect all areas of the career, of the occupation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Detmer, that's a great question, because I think if you quickly took a survey of what construction programs and what line programs they have in the state of Minnesota, you'll see that the line workers are in need of people, and yet they're not training. In my industry, the construction electrician industry is changing so fast. Remember the power limited technician bill? Right. It was all about low voltage work. This industry is changing to the point where the communications, the low voltage, the integrated system is going to dominate construction as far as the ability to transmit power and power up devices. So the industry is changing, but the school system isn't. So the technology is going far ahead of what the school system is doing right now. And if I was offering an opinion, I'd say that they're looking for the revenue to keep the school going versus look at the technology that's changing and change with it. We'd love to participate in that effort, too. Because my industry, with the low-voltage industry, sound communication, public address,
integrated building systems and things. They don't have a single program out there that's training for that. And you'll probably hear some technology testimony later on today as the Joint Committee is receiving some of that. So, thank you.
Other questions? Representative Norton, do you have your hand up? I thought you were looking at your nails.
No, thanks.
Great.
Slap them.
Too far away. Thank you, Mr. Chair, I think. And Mr. Claypatch, I've spoken with you about this recently, but I wondered if one of the things that we hear in this committee and others is that the state demographer is painting some pictures about demographics and what the future holds, and that there are going to be many shortages in many areas. And we hear that about this, too, that demographics are changing. All those of us that are the baby boomers will all be retiring, and we need these people trained. Could you address that for me?
I appreciate it. Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, thank you so much for asking that. The slide up on the screen right now is exactly addressing that as Bureau of Labor Statistics. I've said don't use them because it's not reflective, but even if you use what the college system is currently using for identifying what they think the need is, you can see that they're already projecting over 162% more than what they actually need by using national statistics. Now, if you take a look at 20% unemployment, and you see we should employ the people that have already trained in this industry and put them back to work. I mean, these statistics are national. They don't have nothing to do. But then again, if you take a look at Session Weekly, which I think came out last week, and you take a look at the very back page and you look at the construction numbers, and all the numbers are just really taking a header there. And there's no good news for anybody sitting in this room if you're a construction worker, except for the bonding bill, hopefully the tax bill. Thank you again. And transportation bill, thank you. And the Mall of America, thank you again for in the future. But anyhow, my whole point is the unemployment needs are far greater than what they're using their statistics to supply, and they're using national statistics. And somehow, again, we've got to find that cycle that matches the needs in the state of Minnesota. Because what happens when you don't, the people that are trained in this industry and the numbers that you may see is graduation rates, those people are exiting the state of Minnesota to go find work elsewhere because they've put 18 months into the vocational system, the technical system for a training program, and they want to work. They have part of their life in that. They've chosen a vocation. So they're going to go where the work is. And Minsky allows out-of-state contractors come into their schools and offer people jobs to take them directly out of state. And that's got to stop, too, in the interest of placement numbers. So, thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Claypatch, you're talking about construction electricians. We may have to call on Minsky for this answer, but maybe you do know. Does Minsky train in the electrical field other than construction electricians? I mean, do they have, and you alluded to the low voltage, saying that they don't, but there's certainly other fields in the electrical. Could you give me some idea of what their training, what their programs are, how many different kind of areas they train in?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, I think I'd probably make the answer up, so I don't think that that's in the best interest of the committee. I think I spoke earlier saying that the industry is changing, but I can truthfully say that there's a good portion of all the construction electrician programs are the ones that they're predominantly heavily weighted in. So that's probably the answer that I'd be able to put. I wouldn't be able to tell you exactly how many numbers of schools train for outside linemen and the limited energy industry.
Mr. Chair, would it be nice if I could get that from Minsky at some point, kind of a breakdown of what they are they're doing
Minsky
with the electricians?
Representative Mahoney, if Minsky wants to come down and comment or refute anything that's said, I'm certainly going to invite them down to the table after we're done with questions here. Representative Poppy and then Senator Robin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hello, Mr. Claypatch. I have a question. You talk and correct me if I'm mishearing what you said. You talked about Minsky's training not necessarily adapting to meet the need as low voltage is changing and other things. Can you tell me what IBEW is doing to help maybe alter the training that the electricians are getting to help meets additional need, and that could be low voltage, it could be more in the wind power or solar or other kinds of things that are coming forward.
We'd be happy to. Mr. Chairman, Representative Poppe, thank you. We operate apprenticeship training programs, so as people graduate or they come right out of high school and want to enter into the electrical industry, we train them. It doesn't cost the state a penny. $3 million in my program every year that's paid for. The people that are working contribute to the Apprenticeship Training Center, and the same goes for all the four other local unions throughout the state of Minnesota. The way we address those needs, we have also an apprenticeship center that stands alone just for the limited energy industry. So for all the alarm communication, public address communications issues, we have a completely separate statewide apprenticeship training center for that industry. Our contractors who pay our wages and who part of that wage goes to the training for our apprenticeship center, the funding for the apprenticeship center, feed back to us where the industry is going. And so as we do that, the training centers operate no different than anything else. We've got a board that meets. And as we see the needs in the industry, we make capital improvements for our apprenticeship centers and train for the future. We currently in St. Michael at the training center in IBW 292, which I'm most familiar with, just invested $250,000 in solar training. We have the only NAPSEP certified lab in the entire United States. And we train our members for an industry that's going to be emerging. I would imagine that down in IBW 343 in the south part of the state in Rochester, they're probably looking at putting a wind turbine in for the same reason for that. We train for instrumentation, which is a high need in the ethanol industry for instrumentation. That's done in IBW 110 local. And then we also have reciprocity between local unions. So if you want to take a class in Excel or continue your education and meet the needs so that your employer can use you in a different arena, we allow people to go from apprenticeship center to apprenticeship center to get that training.
Mr. Chair, just one follow-up. And Mr. Claypatch, the people that are currently in the room that are unemployed and are beyond apprenticeship at a journeyman level or whatever, are they able to access that training?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Poppe, thank you. I should have addressed that. If I wasn't clear, it's their training center also. So if I wanted to enter the industry and I wanted to go back to school, I'd go back and take solar, let's say, or instrumentation. We have OSHA 10 classes, everything, and continuing education for our license requirements is all done at our training center. So we're self-contained. Thank you. Senator Roman.
Thank you. And there's another whole sector that provides training for electricians, the private sector. And I'm just curious, with the electricians here, how many of you received your training from Dunwoody or another private institute? Just pick up your hand. So there's a significant number, which we really don't have control over. And, you know, even if Minsky cut back, I guess the main thing is that we have to get out the message that there's not a whole lot of jobs available. Because if students really want to get this training and Minsky doesn't have open slots, they may go to a private institute, and if the demand is high, the private institute may offer more slots. So we kind of end up not solving the problem at all, and there's really not much we can do about it if the privates decide to go ahead and increase their capacity in that area.
Former Representative Pence.
Yeah, I am former, right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And maybe when we do have Minsky come down and speak, we could ask them about career counseling, because it does seem to me that students need to have accurate information about what the opportunities are for jobs, and that also could have an impact on what choice they make in terms of what program they go into.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. Further questions? One final comment, and just to answer Senator Roebling and question about private schools. There's 16 Minsky schools that teach construction electricians, and there's two private schools. So it's an 8-to-1 ratio. So we are in conversations with Dunwoody. We have specific problems with Dunwoody as far as graduates being able to pass our aptitude test. So we would think that they'd even want to have people that go into a vocation be able to just enter our program and have the ability to pass the aptitude, especially after committing 2 years of training at a private institution, which is higher than Minsky's fees, too. So 8-to-1 ratio.
It was a good question. How many people in the room went to a two-year Minnesota institution, Minsky system? Okay. quite a bit more. You still can't sweat them. Anyway, and then how many went through the apprentice program which is the overwhelming majority. Okay. Any other questions for the committee? If not, then would Minsky, does Minsky want to comment on anything?
Mr. Chairman, thanks on behalf of the IBW.
Thank you very much for coming here. And members,
thank
we
you.
Hope that you aren't. As a matter of fact, my daughter's boyfriend is a member of your union, and he just got laid off on Thursday, and he was taking the solar class at your
It must have been your daughter that called me already.
Yeah. You didn't help her last time either, Claypatch. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair?
No comments. I didn't recognize
you. The typewriter didn't say anything in this room.
Welcome to the committee. And you've heard the testimony, so briefly, we do have somebody coming on in about 10 minutes. So. Welcome.
Chair Recovina and Chair Pavis, I'm Linda Baer, the Senior Vice Chancellor for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. We are here to present on some interesting and exciting trends in higher education, and that will follow, but we can give an opening statement anyway, an overview of what we've done since last year in relation to the electricians issues.
Go ahead, Mr.
We did, as the letter said, indicate that we would put a cap on the enrollments to date. And that has happened, and we have had a resultant decrease in the numbers of enrollments. That has happened. I think you had a question about the different varieties of electrician programs included in some of our programming, and while I have some information, I would be happy to get the full information to you about the detail of other programs that we deal with. But we have things across the board, but I'd rather just give you the detail in written copy. You did ask also about career counseling. We do have career counseling, should students avail themselves of the career counseling. We also have several online opportunities, including ISEEK, the Internet System for Employment and Economic Knowledge, Educational Knowledge, which does by region talk about employment and wages available per the career choice that people are choosing at this point.
Welcome.
Chair Rukavina, for the record, Manuel Lopez, Associate Vice Chancellor for Continuous Improvement. Just to give you two quick pieces of information, and the letter was attributed to me, I wrote the letter. The number of graduates from Minnesota Electrical Program in our system declined for the third consecutive year, was down by nearly 10% from the year ago. The number of new students enrolled in Minnesota electrician programs is down in the fall of 2007 by 12% from the preceding fall. And I'd like to point out also that conditions vary. The conditions in the Twin Cities are significantly different than the conditions in southwestern or southeastern Minnesota, so that there are regional variations. And as Dr. Baer noted, students do have basic information about employment and employability, but they also have free choice. And in many cases, they've chosen to pursue this particular occupation as opposed to another. It's very difficult to push a student into an occupation that he or she does not want to pursue. Thank you very much.
Any questions for Ms. Baer and Mr. Lopez?
Senator, to that last point,
and my senator,
yes, proud to be it too. To that last point, though, I realize you can't push them into occupations, but you can certainly encourage them to not go into occupations where there is no jobs. And I think that's part of the problem here, because there's an inordinate number of people who are sitting here who have been off for more than 6 months, indicating that there's a glut of electricians or there's not enough jobs, one or the other, or a combination of both. And I would think that in the Minsky system, when someone walks in and says, I want to be an electrician, it's incumbent upon the system to say, you're not going to get a job when you get out of here, or else you're going to have to leave the state. And is that going on?
Mr. Lopez, do you want to take that one?
Sure. Chairman Recovina, set us something. Yes, it is going on. But again, you can put out a lot of information in terms of what's available. And if a person has a dream and wants to pursue it, it's very difficult to say no. We have, and there are a lot of professions. There are a number of places we know that there are job vacancies, and we have programs in those areas, but we can't recruit students into them for whatever reasons. Part of it may be market factors, salaries, or just plain interest. But students are given information. We require our occupational programs to talk about the placement opportunities or lack thereof. So that is available. And I still think it comes down to a matter of choice.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm really disappointed in your response. I think it's really inadequate. And the two-year colleges, when I tour campuses and talk to the presidents and the staff at the two-year colleges, they always brag about how market-sensitive they are, how they're really in close contact with their local business community, and their rapid response and adapting much better than the four-year colleges and much better than university to what the market forces are. And that's what their whole purpose is to be very job-sensitive and to find jobs for young people as they graduate. And well, here we have an example of a major failure in that system and that philosophy. And you're basically saying, oh, what can we do? Student choice. You know, throw up my hands, there's nothing I can do. I'm really disappointed.
Chair Pappas, there are a lot of other...
Not for me to take on a bunch of union members, but... hold on.
Mr. Lopez. Just a quick response. That you're correct in terms of adaptability, but there are other factors. In particular, in the Twin Cities market, we have an enormous amount of in-migration from other parts of the state. There is no control for that. And if you do some of the analysis, if you look at the analysis of Bureau of Labor Statistics materials and where these people come from, a large number of the construction industry people, not just electricians, in the Twin Cities have come in from outside the Twin Cities. People respond to the market or the perceived market. I think a lot of the local, if you look at it, one of the comments I made, and we can provide written documentation, is that there are regional variations. So 162% is not true across the board. There are some parts of the state where you essentially are producing one electrician for one job opening, or were when the programs were doing that analysis. So I don't think that it's a uniform. It's not a uniform state. It's a state that varies. It's a set of institutions that vary, and they're responding to different local needs.
Representative Mahoney, and then Dentmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question really kind of breaks down. You can put a lot of information out, but I'd ask you to kind of go over how you make sure the student actually sees it. I mean, if it's just on a website and you say you got to go to the website, you know, there's a chance that they do, there's a chance that they don't. But if you hand it to them and you say, you know, in the metro area you got 26% unemployment, you know, the electrical field, that's got a different... It probably has a different weight than saying, you know, you got some problems with employment, you probably just take a look at the website. Although 20-somethings are much more likely to look at the website, it doesn't always mean that they're going to read the website. So I guess my question is, how are you making them aware? And I don't want to beat up on college counselors, because I don't think that's fair. They've got a pretty large, they were such a defense of him last night, I don't want to start that all over again. But could you please tell me how you are getting that information and assuring me that they are actually hearing the information?
Mr. Lopez.
Chairman Rukavina, members of the committee, it's not all web. There are, in many of the institutions put out information sheets by occupational category. These are handed to the students. When students come in and explore it with counselors, this material is handed to them. It is not purely web. There are multiple avenues by which this information is conveyed.
Okay, Representative Detmer, and we'll get our next testifier up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Vice Chancellor Baer, how many different programs are there in electrical education in Menskew that they can get into and then... you know, how many different programs do you have?
Ms. Bear?
Chair Riccovina and Representative Devon, we have 13 programs. I would like to bring you the report on which programs are in which schools at a later date, because I don't have the detail here.
So we have, so basically what we have here today are construction electricians. Mm-hmm. Do you have a program in linemen?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Several.
Well, members, you know, this is the second year in a row that we've had this problem and these numbers presented to us, and I know that I had told Mr. Claypack to try to work with Minskew, and I think they made a good effort, but evidently there needs to be more done, because those numbers are rather startling, I think, and we should really concentrate a little more on this issue, because it has been around now in the second year in a row. Regarding the, just the whole unemployment issue in the state of Minnesota, you know, our economy slowed down. We're in a recession. I guess everybody's kind of admitted that. And I just hope that your members continue to push at the Capitol here that we can get a bonding bill out as quickly as possible to get people to work, and hopefully even a tax bill that may address some of the other issues that we vetoed last year, like the Mall of America and that. So with that, Ms. Bear, I guess you might as well just stay there and introduce Mr. David Miller on for the next part of our joint hearing. I guess we'll just wait till the room clears. Thank you, members, for showing up at your day at the Capitol. Mr. Milleron, welcome to the committee, and I'm sorry your time's a little cut a little short, but I'm sure you can quickly go through your presentation.
Chair Riccovina, we're very pleased to be here, and Chair Pappas, we'd like to thank you for this opportunity.
Go ahead. I think we can hear over the din.
Again, for the record, my name is Linda Baer. I'm the Senior Vice Chancellor for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. I'm standing in for Chancellor McCormick, who asked me to express his regret for not being here because of the death of a family member. His 105-year-old uncle passed away.
And our condolences to him. I knew about that.
Thank you. We're pleased to have this opportunity, though, for Dr. David Milliron to help present to you some of the powerful forces affecting higher education and about how we can best meet students' needs. It's interesting that Dr. Milliron was here, in fact, we were counting, 7 years ago, possibly, and he presented to a joint Senate and House committee such as this one in a retreat in Winona, talking there about the trends and the movement toward changes in higher education. And so it's nice that he's able to come back, albeit to probably mostly a new committee. Does anybody remember being in that group at that time? Okay, well, he's here, though, today. He's been working with colleges and universities across the country on strategic planning and improving the use of data and predictive decision-making. Currently, he's the board chair for the Institute for the Study of Knowledge Management and CEO of Catalyze Learning International, a private consulting group. He has also considerable experience in private industry. In 2005, PBS named Dr. Milliron the recipient of its annual O'Banion Prize for Transformational Work in supporting teaching and learning. I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Milliron.
Welcome, Doctor.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I'm mighty happy to be here and glad to join the conversation about education and the road ahead in Minnesota. I've had the great pleasure of working across your state with a number of different institutions, and I've been working around the country with K-12 school districts, community colleges, and universities on a host of different issues around education. what I'll briefly talk about today and then open up for questions is the idea of catalytic conversation. This is a project I've been doing working with all sectors of education about what are the major conversations that are driving change. I've worked with Board of Regents, with state policy committees, legislative groups, and with on-ground institutions really looking at what are the big change agents that are driving their work, and then really thinking about how they kind of play together and then how you kind of plan for the road ahead. Given it's going to be a pretty interesting time in our funding cycle and our operation cycle in terms of the needs for education, it's a good time to step back and kind of look at all those changes. These are the seven kind of clusters of areas that I've been focusing on in these conversations. They have to do with what I call learning swirls, the impact of globalization, the rise of partnership programs, the expansiveness of institutional advancement, a little bit about building out our technology infrastructures, real push towards what I call insight initiatives, which is kind of a different take on how people are using data. And interestingly enough, they're using data to do program planning for these kinds of things as well. And then also the what I would call the democracy imperative for the world of education. And so what I'll do is just kind of run through these different category areas, talk about some of the resources that inform them. You all will get the PowerPoint presentation. If I talk about a book, it's already hotlinked out to Amazon. If I talk about a website, it's already hotlinked to that website. The whole idea is to just allow for the conversation to continue within it. And please stop me as we go along just so we can jump into conversation as we jump into this. The first major conversation area is around the idea of learning swirls. And learning swirls is taking a different tack at the ways in which people are going into higher education in particular, but also how they're flowing out of the K-12 world. What's really clear is we've got uneven population growth around the United States. You've got uneven population growth in your state. You have some places that are growing, some places that are having different challenges with population. And that is a real challenge for people building out the education infrastructure because you're trying to figure out the need for education. What's pretty clear is that the need for education is going up. If you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, if you look at the Department of Education data, what we can see is that more and more people are going into post-secondary higher education. If you just look at what 30 years ago, I think nationally the data are somewhere between 20-30% of a graduating high school class went on into some kind of higher education, post-secondary certification, diploma, or degree. Those numbers today are close to 65-85% of the graduating students are going on to post-secondary education. So we've almost tripled the amount of people that are going into our world. What's interesting is our high schools were never invented for this. Our high schools are never invented to be college preparatory academies, but that's what they're expected to be right now. I actually serve on a technical panel that is working with the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which is considered the nation's report card. And the NAEP test, the 12th grade NAEP test, was designed always to be a test of achievement. What have students learned in their last 12 years? And that's how they designed the test. They are now fundamentally redesigning the NAEP, the 12th grade NAEP, to be a test of preparedness. How prepared are these students coming out of 12th grade for military training, workforce training, career technical education, and the four-year universities? Great question, because that wasn't the question we were asking before. Now we're asking how ready they are when they walk in the door. Part of the reason we're asking that is because of the need for education. Suddenly society is paying attention to it because it impacts our bottom line, it impacts our economics. But because of that changing need and the need for education, a lot of it driven by the workforce, and I want to make sure this isn't just about credit education, it's also about the explosive use of contract training and non-credit education to really meet the direct needs of the workforce, train incumbent workers and to actually get on the ground working with that. In fact, a lot of major state systems are making the case that they need to pay attention to their non-credit as much as their credit to make sure that they're really meeting the needs of their community in a dynamic way with certifications, diplomas, and degrees. So as we're doing that, we're trying to respond to very different enrollment patterns of students that are coming to us in very different ways. I was on the board of the American Council on Education back in 2002. And what was interesting is back then, they were still dominated by conversations on the traditional students. And if you had to guess, how would you guess they would define a traditional student for higher education? What would you think they'd say?
Someone right out of high school.
Right out of high school, 18 to 22 years old, full-time, not working. And if you actually look at that demographic, that's less than 20% of the credit-bearing higher education students in the United States. The vast majority of students are going in very different kinds of patterns. You still have some traditional students that go through that way, and that's fantastic. But we have a whole group of students, because of the changing demographics, who are going through a very different pattern. They're working. In fact, in Miami-Dade Community College in Florida, they did a study of their full-time students at that community college, and the modal full-time student works 42 hours a week while they're going to school full time. So it radically changes their enrollment pattern. It's one of the reasons why, actually I just wrote an article recently that was published for League for Innovation called Time to Say Goodbye to the Two-Year College. Because the typical two-year college, the modal student takes way more than 2 years to graduate. They take 3 and 4 years to graduate because they're going part-time, they're working, and they're taking care of their families. So people at colleges and universities are really beginning to have substantial conversations about how they restructure their programs. How can they show students 1 year accelerated formats, 2 year formats, 3 and 4 year versions of the curriculum, so they can really wrestle with how they're really going into these into their occupations. And also really reaching out to the reality that many of these students come drastically underprepared for higher education work. I relate to that. I'm a first generation student. I come from a family of 9 kids. I have an African American brother, a Native American brother, and a Korean sister. In addition to that, we had about 25 foster kids who rotated through my house during the time I was growing up. My mom was a special care nurse, and my dad was out of his mind, obviously. Big rowdy. Actually, my dad was an electrician, ironically enough. So I'm deeply connected to the folks that were...
And did he have a job?
And he had a job. He had 9 kids. He had to have a job. He had to find it wherever it was going to be. What was interesting for us is when I walked into higher education, luckily for me, I had Mesa Community College nearby, which opened its doors and really taught me what I needed to learn. But when I walked onto that campus, I literally did not know what an AA was. I didn't know what an AS was or what a BA was. I kind of knew what BS was, right? Because I was faking my way through as I was going through it. But I had to learn a lot of lessons, right? Now, I always juxtaposed that with my kids. Everything, I have a 9-year-old daughter, an 8-year-old son, 4-year-old son. Every single one of them, within 3 days of their birth, had a University of Texas at Austin onesie on in the crib, right? Their full expectations that they were going to go on into higher education. They'll be ready for it. Again, I go back to that data. 30 years ago, only 20% of a graduating high school class moved on into post-secondary higher education. Now we've almost tripled that number. That other 80% had kids. So we have at least a generation and a half of underprepared students we're going to have to wrestle with. That's not going to go away for 10 to 15 years. We're just going to have to deal with that in our system. And there are good programs where people can be really successful with that. A couple good resources on this that I would encourage you to take a look at. One is on the screen, I have an icon for Know How to Go. Know How to Go is actually funded by the Lumina Foundation. Great initiative. It reaches into middle schools and high schools and to returning adult students and really helps them understand the ways they can go into higher education and make their dreams a reality. Things like find somebody in your life who can inspire you and motivate you to move through. Make sure you pick the right kind of institution, whether it's a 4-year university or a community college. Make sure that you take rigorous courses so you're ready to be successful and put your hands on some cash. That's one of the ways you can finance your higher education. And they try to speak the language of those kids so they can actually get themselves ready to move on into that world, which is kind of nice. The second thing is because of the need for learning swirl and people being more responsive to the people coming at all different ages and stages, this is a really fundamental concept. People are really beginning to think about their system differently to reach out and to be able to make a case for education. I want to show you a couple little commercials that have been put together by the American Council on Education and the folks at the American Ad Council, which I think are pretty telling when people are trying to make the case for education.
At one level, how
this is a brief introduction, and I'll show you two commercials that come from this movement.
Education is a bit stuffy, and they know that, and I make fun of them because of that. So we decided to lighten up a little bit and let the American people know that without colleges and universities, we would not have first-line responders. 83% of all first respondents, police and firemen, have been trained and taught in our community colleges. We create the environment. Again, we are the engine that prepares the people who solve the problems and teach the people who change the world.
Hello, 911.
Someone's trying to break into my house.
Sorry, ma'am. My local community college had its budget cut, so we're no short on police at the moment.
What?
Yeah, do you happen to have a rolling pin or a golf club?
No.
You know any kicks to press a hole? How about jiu-jitsu?
Jiu-jitsu?
Less support for higher education means fewer trained police. 83% of first responders are trained in community colleges.
Are you limber? Can you run?
American colleges and universities. We teach the people who solve the problems and change the world.
We've got a 63-year-old male hand stuck in a pickle jar.
This man needs bloodletting fast, right away.
Cough, lightheaded. What would you prescribe?
Bloodletting.
Bloodletting. Very good.
So broken. Take 6 more pints.
Less support for higher education means fewer medical breakthroughs. open heart surgery, and other advancements came from colleges and universities. America's Colleges and Universities. We teach the people who solve the problems and change the world.
What I love about this is the fact that the people of the American Council on Education, and actually with the reauthorization of the Higher Education Act, if you've seen that bill, is they're beginning to really embrace the notion of learning's world, that we don't just have this neat linear pipeline of students that are coming to us anymore. Students are coming into higher education in all different ages and stages, and we need to find ways of reaching out to adult students and the younger students and looking at the diversity of people and how they're coming in. Because of that, and because it's such an important part, it's one of the reasons why people are really thinking about the notion of globalization. And I bring up globalization quickly to put this in context. We're not the only ones that look at the learn-to-earn phenomenon and are trying to take some kind of action. Internationally, they're getting into this game in a big way. Europe has initiated something called the Bologna process, which is all about connecting all the universities across Europe to be able to allow for better transfer of students between them and the flow of individuals between that system. And they've really done some very interesting things to stand that up. You also have the rise of what I call the BRIC countries. The BRIC country stands for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and Korea, all of them investing deeply in education, trying to expand. And what's interesting is in many of those places, it's not just the high-end research universities they're investing in. They're really realizing they have to get to the community and technical college level. China, for example, is opening about 200 different community colleges in the course of the next 5 years. They're trying to get at that workman level, where that level of the middle class, where they're really trying to get that kind of information. And they're modeling the U.S. system. They're coming here and just definitely trying to steal great ideas from us and figure out how they can make it work. In fact, in Canada and in Australia, they openly call it what they call their positive immigration strategy. They're using their education system to bring high-level, high-qualified individuals into the country to get educated and then encouraging them to stay. The whole idea for them is to get positive inflow of highly talented people so their workforce can be more competitive. It's a really interesting thing. But one of the big things they're talking about, everyone talks about Thomas Friedman and the world is flat when you talk about globalization. He's the op-ed Elvis these days talking about this notion. I'm a bigger fan of Richard Florida's work in The Flight of the Creative Class. He's an economist who, from George Mason University, senior scientist with the Gallup organization, data guy. And what his data show him is that the world is not flat. It's connected, but it's spiky. Some communities are on the rise and others are falling to the floor. And a lot of it's based on whether or not they're investing in education, beauty, art, and music. And because we're in a connected world, people live where they want to live and they go places they want to go based on the infrastructure. And so if you look like you have a vibrant community that is investing in these things, that's where they want to go. I live on a 40-acre farm in rural western North Carolina. And part of the reason I live there is because my work is national and I can live anywhere I want to live. My wife is a southern girl and I learned the maxim that if mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. So I moved back to North Carolina. But I absolutely love living there. I love living in rural communities. I do a lot of work in rural communities, especially with the Appalachian Initiative. But I would not have been able to make that choice 10 years ago. It's because of the high-speed internet access and the communications infrastructure, I can run a national, international company from that venue. I can call it Silicon Hollow, right? The whole notion you can bring that work anywhere and do all kinds of exciting work. So, in context, learning swirl, changing patterns of enrollment, people coming at all different ages and stages, in a globally connected world where all of us are trying to get on the same page, it's one of the reasons why in education people are furiously working on partnerships. They're getting K-12 together with community and technical colleges, together with universities and corporations and governments. You're seeing real presses for the expansion of dual enrollment programs where students in high school can get early college level work. In fact, I have an icon up there for Mission Early College High School in El Paso Community College. It's a partnership with UT El Paso, El Paso Community College, and their high school district, funded by the Gates Foundation. And the Gates Foundation will tell you, of the hundreds of millions of dollars they've spent on educational innovation in the last 5 years, the one program that they know they have data on that actually works is early college high school. It's the ability to engage students as early as possible, especially in core disciplines. What they're finding out is we're killing boys in high school, especially by eliminating career and technical education opportunities in high school. They're falling off the map. And in focus groups, I've heard the boys say, if I have to sit through one more English lecture for 2 hours, I'm going to stab my eyes out. Because they don't have any other hands-on applications that they're a part of. There's nothing that draws them in. It's one of the reasons why high schools are really wrestling with how do they bring back athletics, music, art, and the vocational, occupational programs, because those were many times what drew people in to stay in school in the first place. It's one of the reasons why we're having problems with boys staying in school. So a lot of K-12 university, K-12 community college partnerships, especially early college, high schools, and dual enrollment programs. But then you're also seeing a lot of community college university partnerships, articulation and transfer agreements, aggressive. Every state now has a P16 council, P20 council, K20 initiative. Florida, of course, blew up their governance board and created a K20 super board that is over all of their education system. They've got lots of issues with that in terms of how they're trying to put it together. But one of the things that came out of it is Florida is the first state in the United States that has a full articulation agreement between all public community colleges and all public universities and all private universities. So students can move between any of their sectors. And they're using it, by the way, as an economic development cookie. If they go out to the companies, encourage them to come in, they talk about their educational infrastructure and how people can easily get early college work in high school, and they can move their way all the way through in the partnership. Powerful kinds of programs on the partnership side. Now, all that's coming in this context of a down economy. You're seeing budget cuts probably in this state right now, people trying to figure out what they're going to do with the budget cuts. I would argue you're going to see more and more of these colleges and universities get pretty aggressive about institutional advancement. I'm not going to spend a ton of time on this, but what's very clear is that I think 2008, 2009 are going to be the year of education budget cuts across the country. You're already seeing it. I think you've already got proposals within the state to wrestle with it. The colleges and universities that really get their arms around these 5 points of the STAR: legislative relations, so people know exactly what they need to be funded on; broad alumni development, not just to raise money, but to build friends and to deliver on your brand promise; aggressive grant writing to fund your programs and student services; entrepreneurship, working with business and industry to develop entrepreneurial partnerships that really can help fund your programs; and then especially private fundraising. There are $13 trillion concentrated in the 65 and over market right now that is going to be in bequest and bequeath in the course of the next 10 to 15 years. Higher education needs to be in the mix. My problem is it's way too concentrated at the top right now. Harvard has a $36 billion endowment. There are 50 other universities in the country that have multi-billion dollar endowments. Let's just take the opposite example. Look at all 1,200 community colleges in the country who educate 45% of those in higher ed. They account for less than 1% of the endowment income in higher education. So what's happening is more and more of those folks are trying to get into the mix to talk about how they can fund all this stuff. Now, I talk about all that stuff first to take a second to talk about technology. I don't talk about technology first, about trend in terms of trends in higher ed, because if you talk about it first, it sucks the oxygen out of the room. It's all anybody wants to talk about. What is pretty clear in the world of technology is we're at a stage now where it's moved out of an innovation stage. It's no longer neat, new, and novel. It is now a core infrastructure in what we do. And so when I work with legislative groups, when I work with major administrators, one of the things I really encourage them to do is to stop thinking about it as a side innovation or something you're using operationally. It is a core infrastructure, and the building metaphor really works. You need to have capital funds for it, operational funds for it, and maintenance plans. In fact, in many colleges and universities, the website is the newest and most beautiful building. It's not the only one. It is part of the kind of whole common infrastructure of what's going on. And I would just encourage you to think about your own life. How many of you at home are on broadband, like DSL or cable? Okay. How many of you have wireless LANs in your house, some kind of a wireless LAN? Look around. The expectations here. What is happening is we've created these digital infrastructures for how we work and how we play and how we interact. The same thing is going to be happening in the world of education. In fact, you're seeing lots of expectations.
Sure.
Good.
Senator Thompson.
Doctor, you should ask how many still have dial-up in their home.
Yeah. What's about that? How many of you still have only dial-up?
And I'm happier than hell, Mr. Bell.
You know what's funny about that is we've written two books on the digital divide. We've done a lot of work on rural communities and others. And one of the things that we've found is that the new digital divide is no longer between being online and not being online. The new digital divide for these kids in education is between being in a community that's broadband and a community that's dial-up. What we're finding is that what people can do on broadband, people behave radically different on broadband than they do on dial-up. Let me just give you one example that kind of, I'm not really thrilled about this, but I understand why they're doing it. What major coffee house was the first one to go wireless, to say that all of them were going to be wireless cafes? Starbucks. In 2005, they said, in 18 months, every Starbucks will be a wireless internet hotspot. There are not many Starbucks in rural communities, right? You don't really see them very often. What major fast food chain just said they're going to do it? McDonald's. So McDonald's has now committed that in the next 2 years, every McDonald's will be an internet high-speed wireless hotspot.
Yeah, I don't need DSL.
See,
that
is.
I'm just putting it on.
Here's my problem. It's powerful Machiavellian marketing. And what I mean by that is that in those rural communities and inner-city communities where they can't afford broadband,
where are the kids going to spend their time? They're going to go hang out at McDonald's because that's where they can get online. And I mean, they're smart to do it. That's why they're doing it, to be able to get it in. And the irony is, of all ironies, I always love this. If you stay at a Holiday Inn, the internet's free. If you stay at a Four Seasons, it's $15. You know, it's the same thing. They're going to be free in these communities, but it's part of the reason they're getting on. Our country's pretty interesting with broadband. We're 21st in the industrialized countries in broadband penetration in terms of high-speed internet. Luxembourg just passed us. We pay 10 times as much for broadband as other countries do. And part of it is because other countries are really looking at it as an infrastructure. It's like the light switch. It's part of what you do to kind of live. And like I said, rural communities are coming to life because now when they get broadband, you're able to run companies out of those rural communities you couldn't run otherwise that allow you to do all kinds of things. Same thing in the world of education. The expectations are there in the world of education where students expect to have mobility, they expect to have blended. And this is a big thing. People are still arguing over what's better, online or face-to-face education. That is no longer the argument. The argument is all about the middle. In the future, you're going to see 10 to 15% pure play online, 10 to 15% pure play face-to-face, and most of everything else is going to be a blend. It's going to be 90% online, 10% face-to-face, 90% face-to-face, 10% online, and everything in between. And you're already seeing that all around the country. People are doing this. And by the way, we're blending our own lives. I've got WebMD on the screen right now because I used to do work in the medical community. And doctors tell us that we're driving them bananas because we go to WebMD and fully self-diagnose and come in with printouts when we go to the doctor's visit. Right? And if they ever tell us something in our doctor's visit we don't understand, we go check it out immediately because we've blended our own lives. The same thing is happening in the education space where you're seeing people kind of make this move. It's a very different kind of environment. And thinking about this infrastructure means planning for it. Now, one of the things I want to make sure we talk about is a lot of people always want to talk about the millennials and the new students who are coming, and that's the major reason why we need to use technology. And I'm going to argue absolutely not. I'm going to say it is part of a larger set of conversations. Again, learning plural. People are coming at all different ages and stages. It's not just about millennials. That's one of the reasons why I like the book Educating the Net Generation better than the book Millennials Rising. Millennials Rising is too hyperbolic for me. Educating the Net Generation is much more practical. And one of the things they talk about is in our education system, particularly with adult learners, you're going to have a combination of baby boomers, Generation X, and Net Generation folks in many places sitting side by side. Especially with those returning students, people who are career changers, displaced workers, you're going to really have to think about how you reach all these generations and think about your infrastructure so you can be nimble enough to meet all their needs. But these generations have different experiences with technology, right? The boomers grew up with typewriters and telephones and TV and memos and a real strong family focus. Gen X grew up with video games, PC, emails, and a real strong kind of individualist focus. Sociologists call the boomers the family generation, the Xers the me generation, and the rise of edutainment. The net generation has grown up very differently. My kids have grown up very differently. They've grown up always knowing the world with the World Wide Web. My niece came around the corner the other day and announced to us that she had just Googled her boyfriend. We told her to never say that in front of Nana because she will not understand it. She'll have a very different opinion on it afterwards. They've known a world with cell phones and instant messages and MP3 players. And what the sociologists will tell you is they call this the we generation, deeply social, deeply connected, very different kind of infrastructure. So part of our goal is to create an infrastructure that reaches all of them. And so you're seeing a lot of different innovations from, you were talking about how do you get career counseling, for example, to individuals to make sure they get connected with it. Part of the challenge for us is to make sure that we've got different infrastructures to reach different kinds of clientele. Next generation students might want to use the web, but you're going to have displaced workers who need very different kinds of career counseling. So how do you blend all this together? By the way, businesses get this big time. They're doing CRM. Customer relationship management is all about web phone field. It's about face-to-face interaction over the phone and over the web and blending it comfortably. Just think about your airlines, right? You can do almost everything you can do face-to-face online. You can also do it over the phone, and you can also do it face-to-face. It's about blending those infrastructures. The same thing coming to the world of education. And once we get that infrastructure in place, you're going to see more and more people doing things like gaming. If you haven't seen the book Got Game, How the Gamer Generation is Reshaping Business Forever, it'll help challenge your thinking about how games can be used in the world of education. Because here's the problem. When many people from different generations see this stuff, they think gaming is just fun, frivolous stuff, 17-year-olds who are spending too much time in their room. That's not what the data actually say about this. In fact, this book, the chief scientist from IBM says what they're seeing in the HR ranks
is that it might just be the massive multiplayer online gamers are better prepared for the workforce than some of the college graduates we're seeing. And it's because they have to work with thousands of people, they have to provide leadership, they have to work in teams. Here's part of the problem. When they've actually done what's called root metaphor studies. When somebody says gaming, video gaming, to people from the boomer generation or beyond, they think of pinball. When they say gaming to the Gen X generation, they think of Atari. When they say gaming to this generation, they're thinking of playing with a headset over the internet with thousands of concurrent people. Very different way of playing. They're thinking of the Wii, for example. How many of you have seen the Wii? Okay. And seeing the Wii in practice, my son will come down after playing the Wii for an hour dripping with sweat. Okay. Have you seen the Wii? I'm going to show you. We'll just take a second to show this. I think it's important to get this in context.
Anti-Gloria. I even had Anti-Gloria bowling.
By the way, their engineering design slogan for the Wii is the Wii for all. So everybody.
Wii was nice to play.
I have friends with a physical therapist who are now using the Wii for what they call rehabilitation. They're actually in physical therapy communities using the Wii for the repetitive moments. Look it up. They're doing it right now. They're installing, the Carnegie Literacy Center is using the Wii. It hooks drugs kids in the libraries. They're developing, and what's interesting about the wireless and the gaming environment is they're really working hard to create educational environments that create the oasis effect. And by the oasis effect, I mean it's a place where students want to stay. For example, I was at a college in Alabama recently that where a student in a focus group said, I have four classes here. Three of them are on ground, one of them is online. By the way, that's the mode. The average student taking an online course is taking two or more on-ground courses at the same time. They're hybriding whether we like it or not. And what he says is, on Mondays, from 8:30 until, you know, like an hour and a half, I get out of my class, I have a three-hour break until my next class. And what I'd like to do is go to the student union and open up my laptop and get on my online course. But the problem is they don't have a wireless LAN here on campus. They want me to go to the lab. At the lab, you got to get a blood sample and a DNA swab or whatever it is to use the lab. I don't want to do that. It's too cumbersome. So I get in my car and I drive to the local coffee house that has an internet cafe. Problem is I have to pay $4 for, you know, a cup of coffee. I didn't get on my class. I stay there too long, so they make me buy a muffin. And then once I'm there for 3 hours, I drive back to campus, and by then I've lost my parking spot. What I'm really worried about, folks, is I don't want our students to have to leave our campuses to go to McDonald's to do their learning. Right? We want them to be able to stay. So I was at a college recently that redesigned their library and literally put a Starbucks in the middle of their library. They put meeting tables all the way around that and plexiglass meeting rooms around that, and then the outside library. Their library went from averaging 150 students a day staying in the library studying to 1,500 students a day. They created the oasis effect to draw those people on, part of the infrastructure for their campus and the engagement. People think technology will drive them away. No, it actually connects them in, especially when you think about the mobile uses of these devices that are standing it up. Something about gaming real quick. Average age of gamers now is 33 in this country. A lot of people think it's all the kids. Fastest growing cohort is over 50, in particular with the senior citizen community. Why do you think the senior citizen community is taking off with gaming?
leisure time.
They have the time. They have the money. What else?
They love playing Wii.
They love playing Wii. Well, actually, low-impact exercise and social. They can be, they're installing it for the socialness. They can actually get sick. They're all multiplayer games. A couple of other big reasons. Brain research has said if you want to save off Alzheimer's and dementia, one of the most important things you can do is try something that makes you a rookie every year. Something that stresses you, and what they're actually prescribing things like gaming so that you can, you know, keep your brain fresh. And I love that line, be a rookie every year. I think we all should pay attention to that. But the other thing is grandkids. If you have it, they will come, right? Grandkids. And as part of research I'm doing for a book for Justy Bass, I went to a senior citizen community and watched a 72-year-old man playing EA Sports NBA basketball on an Xbox 360 on a headset with his two grandkids. His grandkids were in different states. They were all playing at the same time on the same side. They were playing a German team, and not a computer-generated German team, a team that was in Germany. And they were all playing over the internet at the same time. The best part of it was when his grandkids got on Google to look up German trash-talking terms they could use during the game. Right. So I talked to the guy afterwards and interviewed him. He said, you know what's great about this? I used to have these yes and no, five-minute conversations with my grandkids. He goes, now I have these 3-hour game sessions with them that are just amazing, and then we end up talking about the game, and then we end up talking about all kinds of other things after that. Because 3 years ago, I would have been the top curmudgeon telling you the video games are bringing this country to hell in a handbasket. Because I never, ever would have thought that video games would have brought me closer with my grandkids. He goes, and you know what it is? He goes, it's the same as taking them to a baseball game. If I spend time with them, we do something together, it's a shared experience, and it's interactive. And it's because it's not pinball. It's not Atari. These are very different kinds of infrastructure. I'd encourage you to go and look at gaming education. Lots of good resources on this. This quote from The Economist that talks about how important games are being used. Look at, if you want to take this seriously, there's a website called seriousgames.org. Seriousgames.org shows you how the military is using gaming, and they take it seriously, how medicine is using gaming, and how the world of education is using gaming to teach. Very powerful stuff. But you have to have the infrastructure to make this stuff work. And it's related, by the way, very closely with things like social networking. Facebook and MySpace are the social networking things you know about, but I'm talking about using social networks. And by the way, a lot of people only know the trash about these things. They don't know the good things some of these social networks are doing. I encourage you to read Rolling Stone this week and look at how the political candidates are using social networking to actually organize their political campaigns. Absolutely fascinating. How they're combining their online resources to get on-ground activity. And one of the things they found out is it's called the Beyond the Howard Dean Effect. Not just using the internet to raise money, it's to engage the social network and to get them to do traditional political things on the ground. Absolutely fascinating as we're trying to stand that up. Think about Wikipedia is completely built as a social network. If you haven't been to Wikipedia, online encyclopedia that's 15 times the size of Britannica, and it was fully developed free, it's available in 10 languages, and they will tell you the thing about it is it's the genius of a social network. If there's a mistake in Wikipedia, it can be taken out in 5 minutes. If there's a mistake in your Britannica, how long does it take to get out? You got to wait for your next edition and you pay for it, right? And so colleges are beginning to share. I like OER Commons is a curriculum sharing resource where faculty are beginning to actually share curriculum with each other, what I call the case method. Faculty like to copy and steal everything. If somebody else does it well, they want to pull it in and share it with each other. This thing has been up for 5 months, and they have 20,000 licensed free learning objects that faculty members have been able to share, which has just been fantastic. Lots of good resources for this. I won't spend a ton of time on it. But it's about building out the infrastructure. Whether it's iTunes University, Big Think, or 4ATV, all these big resources coming up, and people beginning to think differently about this infrastructure. I'm just going to quickly tell you a story about Western Governors University. We have 10,000 students in our university. And one of the things that we found is that 16 to 18-year-olds are different than the boomer generation. The boomer generation wants you to spend time and talk with them one-on-one. This generation really doesn't want print. If you send them a view book with a letter from the dean, they hate it. They really don't want email, by the way. In fact, one of our focus groups, one of the 16-year-olds, said, email's what old people send me. That just hurts. She says, if you want me to answer in a day or two, send me an email. If you want me to answer in a minute or two, you send me a text message. Okay? Because that's how they're communicating, with text messages, instant messages, Facebook, and the rest. Very different kind of infrastructure. So technology is really changing this. The problem with this, with all these innovations, and I want to go back,
learning for rural partnership programs, globalization, raising more money with institutional advancement, really building out our technology infrastructure. I want to go back to that. Our technology is not a frivolous side item. It's an infrastructure. And you've got deferred maintenance like anybody else. If you had a truck fleet and you actually deliver things, guess what? You got to keep your truck stuff. If you've got buildings that have deferred maintenance, you got to keep it up. Your technology infrastructure is one of your newest buildings. You've got to make sure it's kept up. And you got to think about how you fund it. I think it's funded in a very different way. It's one of those things that's got to be part of your infrastructure funding and planning. But a part of that, by the way, to make sure you know you're not throwing good money after bad, this is my biggest bang for the buck, is you've got to start really putting in the effort to measure whether or not what you're doing, the innovations you're trying, the technologies you're using, are making some kind of a difference. I feel pretty strongly about this one. In the corporate world, the rise of insight initiatives are initiatives that combine hindsight and foresight in a moment of insight so you can make a better choice. Technologically, that's data mining, predictive modeling, so you can make a better choice in that moment, are the thing. If you want to read a great book on this in the corporate world, it's a book called Competing on Analytics, The New Science of Winning by Tom Davenport. It talks about Disney and Walmart and Harris Casino and Marriott and Yahoo and Amazon. And they talk about how people are making small moves and has a huge difference on their bottom line. And one of the things they talk about is that people are no longer just throwing investment money into technology and innovation. And Linda and I have talked about this a lot. I use the metaphor that I think a lot of people did a lot of change management in corporate world and in the education world in the 90s. We did MBO, TQM, TQI, reengineering. You remember all those things. You probably have the teachers from those initiatives. Then in the late 90s, I would argue a brand new change initiative hit our world, and it's what I call the Techno-Cro-Magnon theory. And the Techno-Cro-Magnon theory is really simple. Technology. Good. That's it. That's the whole theory. Whenever you talk to anybody about how they were going to improve their school or their college, they would just tell you about the technology they were buying, hardware they were buying, and the software they were installing. And in the corporate world, they called this the age of irrational exuberance, right? That's what Alan Greenspan called it. With the dot-com boom, then came the bust. They're still interested in technology in the corporate world, but they're asking hard questions about whether or not just technology, but anything they're doing is really making a difference. You're seeing this happen all over the place. And the thing is, you're living with it every day. How many of you shop at Amazon.com or have shopped at Amazon.com? What happens at Amazon after you buy a book? It immediately tells you people like you who bought this book bought this, this, and this, right? Does it take them a week or more to get that to you? No, it's within a second to get there. And that's how fast their algorithm runs. And that's predictive modeling about the future combined with data mining about the past. In 1 second, they give you recommendations that are tailored to you. Think about it from the credit card side. My wife got a call from a credit card company asking her if she'd lost her credit card. And she said, I don't think so. And they said, we think you might have. Why don't you check? And so she got into her purse and opened up her wallet, and sure enough, her credit card's gone. So her next question is, well, how did you know? And she ended up not letting the guy off the phone. And she found out that the credit card company had been watches all of our cards, that she had lost the card about 2 hours earlier at a local coffee shop. The person then went to a gas station within 5 miles of her house, but it was a gas station she doesn't normally go to. So the predictive model said, start watching the card. Then, this is the one that freaks me out, they bought an amount of gas she doesn't normally buy. Okay. She owns a Suburban. It takes $600 to fill up her car. Okay. So they knew something was wrong. They called her, and sure enough, it wasn't her using the car. I just think about that. Millions of customers worldwide, and all because of these use of data, somebody in India called a woman in North Carolina, and they're able to turn off the car. What people in education are beginning to think about in this, and you've got some leaders in the state, by the way, Chancellor Linda Baer actually wrote a wonderful article in EduCon's review about action analytics, is they want to use these kind of analytics to say, a student just did this and did this. They're about to drop out. Why don't we intervene right now? Okay? That's what we're trying to do. Things like, students like you who've had this problem in algebra found these learning objects to be useful. Students like you who are considering electrician as a career have found these other careers to be more enticing because they actually had jobs associated with them, right? Imagine if you had a system like that where you can nimbly make that kind of a move. Those are the kinds of reasons people want to get into these kinds of initiatives. But we've got problems in our systems, and you're not alone. Across the country, this is a problem. You want to study what's happening in your system. People go out and find the studies. They do the studies. They come back. They argue about the quality of the data. By the time it gets to you, it's been more than a year that they've done that study. Then you want some more information collected. They collect that information. They bring it back, and they start the initiative. The challenge is 1 second to 1 year, right? Amazon takes 1 second to make that choice. And the students want to know, how can you use information about me to help me, right? They want to know how you can actually help them make better choices, like choosing the right kind of career. Last thing I want to talk about is the notion of a democracy imperative. All of this is for a reason. The reason we're going through all the change we're going through, the reason why we're willing to measure what we want to measure to find out whether or not we're being successful across all these different innovations is because education is just drastically important. Drastically important to help people get great jobs. We all are committed to that. We want to help people live well, but we also want them to be able to live free. More than ever before, we have interesting times ahead. We're going to have interesting political, religious, and business issues, ethics and science issues, international conflicts, all kinds of interesting and horrible crime like child pornography, hate groups and terrorist organizations that are aggressively using the internet and analytics. So part of our charge is to make sure we really inspire learning, liberal arts, critical thinking, problem solving, decision making, and their ability to actually be good citizens within this community. Education has probably never been more important than ever before. Not to mention the human skills. What's interesting is a lot of the technology and analytics now show us that the human touch is more important than ever before. And being able to make that connection on a human level is absolutely fundamentally powerful. Two books on that, by the way, if you want to read up on that. Ed Hollowell, psychiatrist from Harvard, has a great book called Crazy Busy, Overstretched, Overbooked, and About to Snap. Crazy Busy is a great book. Everybody I've sent it to has told me they're too busy to read it, which is funny. The second book to read is a book called Social Intelligence by Daniel Goleman, which is a follow-up to his book on multiple intelligences, actually a better book. You can't read that book and walk away not feeling convicted about your role as a parent, as a teacher, as a leader, as a legislator, and shaping the minds of the people you work with. It's absolutely fascinating read as you kind of drive through that. So lots of good conversations here, lots of good things to talk about. And what I have found in the world of education, as you start these conversations, you take a deep breath, you buckle your seatbelt, and you get ready. What you want to try to find is that reason center conversation place where you can really get into this. The minute you start talking about these kinds of changes, two groups come out hard and heavy. One group are the caustic cynics. Caustic cynics are angry about everything that's different, and it doesn't matter if you're manna from heaven, too salty for them. They're angry about it. A friend of mine calls them cave people, colleagues against virtually everything. Right? They're only equaled in the challenges they cause by true believers. True believers overpromise and underdeliver, and they cut the credibility out of your initiatives. They say technology will fix everything. They say collaborative learning will fix all of our education. And the truth is, we all know it's about the moderated and thoughtful response in that. Part of your job is to cut through all that and to really think about the thoughtful center. How do you actually find a way to make sure that you're actually being thoughtfully critical, and you're being a careful advocate for these kinds of positions? Because education is just too important these days, and people really care about whether or not we're helping our country, helping our state, helping our regions, but probably more importantly, helping each of those students that come through our school. It's a fun time to be in this school. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Milhon. It was very informative. I think we have to be out of this room in a few minutes, but any questions, pressing questions or comments from the committee members? Senator Pence.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Milhon. I just was curious if we could get a copy of your PowerPoint, and especially the books that you mentioned. You talked very fast, and you covered a lot of material, and I often didn't get them, but I think it'd be interesting to take a look at them.
You had to talk fast. You cut off 15 minutes.
I'll try to play jazz, like I said. Two things. I'll give you the PowerPoint presentation so you have all the links out for the books, but also on the website at markmillery.com, there's a reading list that actually has the books actually lined out, so you can get that. And also, I run a blog called Catalytic Conversations, which is an education blog that has lots of follow-up links and other kinds of resources within that.
Representative Hartman.
Well, I have a question about that blogging thing. When does a person like you blog? I know that as a candidate, I could, as a representative, blog sometime in my life. Did you do that at like 5 in the morning or 1 a.m.?
What's nice about blogging is that it actually allows me to work out some things I'm writing. So if I have to write articles and things like that, I'll blog about it for a bit. And what's really good about it is people who read the blog will refine it for you. They'll come back and, well, have you thought about it this way, thought about that? So I'll just write through some of my writing in chunks, and then people will come back and do it. And then, you know, I write on airplanes and then post it later, you know. But generally, the web blog posts, the blog posts are a lot shorter than any kind of major article. So it's meant to be just kind of quick thoughts. You read an article, you think it's great, you think people might want to read more about it, you create the length of the article, and you just talk about it.
And it starts with, my big thing is, when I work with education institutions, what I've found is the worst thing in the world is top-down, darn it, you will do it kind of leadership. What I've found is the kind of leadership that really works is catalytic conversations, getting people really buzzing about it. So I use the blog as a way to kind of stimulate the conversation and keep that thing going within my business. But you're right, though, time is short.
Representative Hartman, I found the only time, few times I blog, I got myself in worse trouble than I thought.
So. Yeah, make sure you moderate your blog. That's the little part of my
Well, thank you again very much. With that, members' meeting adjourned. Well, to the audience, I apologize again for being late, but on Senate time, we're pretty good so far. Anyway, the session started off a little slow, and then we had a few birthdays to celebrate. So, Representative Norton has some folks here from out of town. So, Representative Norton, why don't you go first, and then I'll take Representative Atkins. Do you have to get back to another committee, Representative Atkins?
I'm going to chair on another committee, Representative.
Okay. Well, we'll come and get you. We'll have a page come and get you when you are ready.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Norton, then. Representative Norton, we can't move your bill, but when we get a quorum, you can move it.
Folks are still working their way over, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for allowing me to present my bill this evening. I'm very excited about this, and just to give you a little bit of history, last year we had a larger version of this bill that was in the K-12 omnibus bill, and it was in there until the final hours of the legislature, and in conference committee, it was taken out, and we were told that it wasn't a K-12 issue, it was a higher ed issue. And by that time, our higher ed bill had already been before the governor one of the times, and I think the last time. And so this year, in working with the Department of Higher Education, we have, knowing the state's budget situation, we have rewritten this pilot. This is a pilot. And so what we're asking the legislature for, and you as a chair, to approve a bill that will give scholarships, grants, however you want to term it, to junior and senior year students in college in order to diversify our teacher workforce. I'm going to have some folks come speak, and I'm not going to speak long this evening because I would much rather have you hear from folks on the ground about the need. I can speak a little bit from my past history as a Rochester School Board member. We actually had a policy as for the Rochester School Board for our district to try to have our teaching workforce represent our student population. And that policy was on the books. It was reviewed annually. We had a department, and actually some of the people in the audience today worked toward meeting that goal and fell far short year after year. And so in looking into it further, we found that our diverse teaching, licensed teaching workforce was only a few percent despite our efforts. And so what we need to do and what we've learned is that we need to get more students in the pipeline, that we simply don't have a pool of students to recruit from. And we worked with Winona State University, who, if you'll look at the language, is one of the pilot sites. They've agreed to work in a partnership with Rochester Public Schools. We have State College State University has agreed to work with Robbinsdale School District, and there's room for two more school district college partnerships that could sign on to this bill and be part of our pilot program. It is only 1 year, Mr. Chair, and we are asking for you to approve this, and it will have it will use for its funding source some Pell Grant. We have some addition to the Pell Grant funds this year, and it will use some of the unspent funds from that enhancement by the federal government. It's a small bill. We're only asking for $200,000 in order to make this work and not pass the Pell Grant. Also, it might be worth noting that we do give preference to low-income students in the language in the bill, just to make certain that we're abiding by the intent of the Pell Grant. Additionally, we are going to recruit from two-year colleges. We know from our experience, and I think from your own, our two-year colleges, our community colleges have a much higher diverse student body, and we want to find those talented students and recruit them into our teacher education program. So those are just some highlights of the bill. What I'd really like for you to hear, Mr. Chair, if you're willing, is from some folks who are here. I've got folks from the Robbinsdale School District and their partner organizations, Rochester Public Schools, and I don't know if, George, you'd like to speak on behalf of Winona State and some others that are here in support, as well as other voices that could talk about
this. Have your guests come down.
Okay.
And if you want to start with the people from the farthest away from Rochester, that's fine. And then and we'll keep the testimony to, you know, a couple of minutes each if we can. But if you want to introduce your guest, well... Superintendent, hi. Nice to see you again. Welcome to the committee. If you just want to introduce yourself to the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members of the House. My name is Romain Dalamon. I am the superintendent of the Rochester Public Schools. Let me begin by sharing with you why I strongly believe that this is the right thing to do for the state. I am before you today as a prime example as to why this bill is something that works. In my former life, I used to be a mental health therapist. And
me too.
And I was awarded a scholarship at the University of Miami to a similar grant. To pursue a degree in mental health. As a result, I became an educator, and I can say that if it wasn't for this scholarship, I would not be sitting before you today as the superintendent of schools. Rochester is changing tremendously, and I can tell you that from what I learned over the past 8 months since I've been a Minnesotan, Rochester is not the only place in Minnesota that is changing. It wasn't long ago where in 1970 we used to have 150 minority families living in Rochester. In 1990, the minority student population was 1,117. Today we're talking about over 4,600 minority students. The minority student population in Rochester is 27.4% of our district's population. The world is changing. Rochester is changing. The state of Minnesota is changing. And we are not preparing our students to only compete with other youngsters who live in the Midwest area. Our students that we're preparing today will compete in a global economy. In fact, it will be a multi-ethnic global economy where our students will have to compete with other youngsters from across the globe, China and India. As a result, making sure that not only we give our youngsters the content knowledge that they need, but also giving them the social competency skills that they need to become successful when they leave our institution is crucial. Having minority teachers in our schools will benefit more than our minority students. Having minority teachers in our schools will benefit our white students as well. Because, again, we are preparing our youngsters to become successful in a multi-ethnic global economy. Our public school education, somebody quoted this once and said that we are not educating the public. We are in the business of creating a public. And as we are creating a public, it is important that we prepare students so they can be successful in their world. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Superintendent Dillon. Questions, Superintendent? Thank you. You've got quite a changing population down there. I know at the hearing that we attended, it was quite interesting. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you just want to identify yourself for the tape.
My name is George Thompson, and I have been a community member for 39 years. I was one of the 150 families that Dr. Dellman talked about. And I'm here to talk a little bit about Winona State, but primarily as a parent, and the need for role models for our minority children. A continued lack of minority teachers means a lack of racial role models, heroes, and authority figures for minority children. It means an ignorance of minority students' learning style, culture, and social and educational and psychological needs. It's a factor in the disproportionate number of African American students suspended or expelled from schools. A diversified teaching staff not only increases the number of role models for students of color, but it also provides, as Dr. Dollman indicated, opportunities for all schools, all students to learn about the ethnic, racial, and cultural diversity in our rapidly changing world. And it also provides cultural brokers to help students understand and maximize their student experience. Students of color tend to have a higher academic, personal, and social experience or performance when taught by teachers from their own ethnic group. Teachers of color also have higher expectations for students from their own ethnic group. We know it's possible. We know you can do it. And I get a lot of this information. This was a study that I did for Winona State, but this information comes from the National Collaboration of Diversity in the Teaching Force. So I'll just leave you with the message that kids are a long-term investment. Carrie and I want to retire. We need to increase the tax base so that we can do those kinds of things. It kind of reminds me a little bit like the oil commercial. Pay me now or pay me later. And Tom, you and I had some discussion at a conference about what the alternative is. If we do not get those kids into school, the alternative is not a good one. So I would urge support of this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. I remember that conversation. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Representative, thank you for having me here this evening. I, too, am a product
Could
of
you
a...
Could you just give your name
for the I'm sorry. My name is Stephanie Crosby, and I'm Director of Human Resources in the Robbinsdale Area Schools. And I, too, have been a product of the Teacher of Color program, and I would like to just share with you the percentage of students of color in our district, as you've heard, is increasing. The percentage of teachers is not. Research shows that educational diversity is a great benefit to all students. It is important for students of color, as well as non-white colored students, to have experiences from teachers of color. Teachers tend to be one person in the authority area outside of the home that have a lot of influence on children. When they only see white teachers, it gives the impression to students of color and to white students that teachers of color don't exist. Teachers of color can also serve as culture brokers, able to not only help students that they navigate their educational and cultural environment, but increase the improvement of students and their parents' involvement. When there are a lack of students of teachers of color in school, there tends to be a higher rate of absenteeism, referrals for discipline, and many more referrals for special education. White students also benefit from the exposure of people of color as we gather and get them ready for a global society. I urge you to put a priority on diversity and culture competency and the ability of teachers of color to bring that student culture and incorporate this into the classroom. We have seen that this will have a great impact on students' test scores and help us close the achievement gap. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Crosby. Any questions, Ms. Crosby?
And Mr. Chair, if I might say, we've had testifiers of color, but kind of similar to the line that we were just talking about, that our students often see white teachers in front of them, but it's important to all, everyone. And I almost feel bad that we have had a parade of minority non-white testifiers, but this issue is not just about Stephanie Crosby or George Thompson or Romaine Dalaman. This, I bring this bill to you because this is important to me too. And so sometimes I feel bad. I feel that we sometimes bring the same people to the table on issues of diversity, but issues of diversity are important to me and they should be important to all of us. So as I just said, I wanted to follow up with her comments, and I do think we have someone from the university that will testify quickly as well.
Welcome to the committee, ma'am.
Good evening. I'm Maureen Prenn, and I am currently acting dean at Minnesota State Mankato. I'm also currently president of MACTE, which is the Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education. And I'm here tonight to speak for both organizations, both MNSCU as a representative of MNSCU, and also of the Colleges for Teacher Education. I really appreciate this opportunity to talk with you and want to let you know first that this issue has been on the agenda for MACTE for the last 2 years as one of our key legislative issues, and I do actually have a short brief that can be passed around at some point here to you. You've heard already from several representatives, specifically people of color. I'm going to give you the higher level view of this. It's not a direct view, but I think that you'll see that it really encompasses all the issues that they were bringing up. You know that we have No Child Left Behind, and of course part of No Child Left Behind is the notion of highly qualified teachers. And we need to ensure that we have a highly qualified teacher for every classroom. The goal of No Child Left Behind is to close the achievement gap. And yet without looking at recruitment for teachers of color into the teaching workforce, we are not going to move towards closing that achievement gap in the way that we need to. We haven't paid as much attention to issues of cultural competence and diversity in the teacher workforce as we need to. Although students of color consist of 40% of today's K-12 classrooms, the educational workforce is made up of only 10% of teachers of color. The issue of diversity in the teacher workforce is especially relevant in Minnesota, where the number of white students enrolled in K-12 education is declining while the number of students of color continues to increase. Over the past 15 years, enrollments by students of color have risen by 134%. Needless to say, districts are anxious to recruit teachers of color as part of their workforce. There are four major reasons for the need for more teachers of color, and cited in a recent 2004 Teacher of Color Summit report. The first and most obvious is that teachers of color serve as role models for all students and counter negative stereotypes that are portrayed in the media and elsewhere in our society. Secondly, all teachers benefit from working in a more diversified workplace. Third, teachers of color demonstrate to students of color that teaching can be a viable career path. And fourth, and I think probably the most important reason, is that as we increase the number of teachers of color, they have a more profound positive impact on the achievement and retention of students of color due to culturally based practices, higher expectations, and roles as cultural mediators and advocates. The State of Students of Color report from 2006 indicates that although enrollments of students of color in higher education continue to rise, participation of many students of color right after high school still lags behind white, non-Hispanic, and Asian students. Affordability is a significant obstacle that many students face when considering applying to college. Funding needs to be a top priority for scholarships to future teachers of color. MACTE and MNSCU support Senator Norton's bill to establish a pilot financial aid program for teachers of color. In addition to increased funding, there's a number of significant actions that need to be taken. And one of those is really going after recruitment, which I believe Senator Norton's bill also deals with by establishing the partnership program. And in this particular case, we need to start recruiting in predominantly ethnic high schools, new immigrant programs, black and Latino churches that have Sunday school and after school programs. We need to focus on culturally responsive recruitment support practices, looking at multicultural curriculum both at the high school and college levels, and developing multifaceted support systems, including financial, professional, and institutional. Developing more university and district partnerships, and pursuing ideas such as Grow Your Own programs. And finally, teachers of color need mentoring and induction support once they are in the classroom to establish a team-oriented support system and help combat feelings of isolation. This bill will contribute greatly to achieving the goals that I have outlined, and I wish to thank you for your time tonight.
Question from Ms. Prince. Does anybody in the audience want to speak in favor or against the bill? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good evening, Representative. I see you folks work really hard and very late, and I appreciate that. My name is Mary Bentz. I'm the Associate Dean for the College of Education and Human Development at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus. I'll be very brief by saying the colleagues and the others who have spoken before me have outlined rationale and reasons why this is important. What I'm here to say is that the Teacher of Color grants that we had in this state approximately 10 years ago were highly successful. The numbers of teachers of color that we were able to recruit, prepare, and have enter into the teaching cadre were greatly increased during the time that those Teacher of Color grants were available. The University of Minnesota partnered with at least 6 different school districts. It was a great opportunity for us to work with districts and to work collaboratively as we were working to prepare very highly educated and well-prepared teachers. So I encourage you very strongly to consider this bill and consider the funding of this bill. Secondarily, from the University of Minnesota perspective, I also appreciate the opportunity to continue to look at this bill into the future to include all undergraduate and graduate teacher education programs. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. Any questions, University? Okay. Ms. Smith from the Minnesota Chamber. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good evening. For the record, my name is Jason Smith, and I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I wish to oppose House File 3885 solely because of the funding source. And it has nothing to do with the program. I think this sounds like a great program. We haven't been able to take a very good look at it, but from talking to Representative Norton earlier, and she's wonderful to work with, it sounds great. So my comments are only reflective of the funding source. The Chamber strongly supports the state grant program, which is in part funded by the Pell Grant, and we support the state grant program. Yes, is this confusing?
No.
Okay.
There's always confusion on my
head. Because the state grant program basically allows limited state dollars to go to students and allows those students to then take those dollars to the institution that meets their needs best, and we think that's the best way to use those state dollars. So because of the way the bill was funded, I just would like to say that I think it begins to erode the state grant program, and therefore we oppose it.
So, okay, thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Smith or the Chamber? Ms. Hegard, welcome. Office of Higher Education.
Mr. Chair, thanks. I'm Susan Hegard, Office of Higher Education, and we worked, our staff worked with Representative Norton trying to craft this bill. We met with her a little over maybe a year ago with Donna Rochester and one of the former superintendents in the school district, and so we worked through some of the issues that she had. I just had a couple of comments. I would echo the concern. The merits of the program are good. We know there's a huge achievement gap that students of color face. Our new accountability report is at the end of the table here, and I think you'll find several ways that we've tried to fill in the graphs there that there's this terrible achievement gap that students face. There's a lot of merit to the program. Our concern sort of twofold. One is, I just wanted to clarify, is this just for public college students, not for private? So
in the pilot.
And our preference, you know, is always to try to, when you're using the state grant money, if that was the funding source, to make sure that it's even-handed, that public and private students could benefit. But our big concern here is there's been this increase in the federal Pell program. I think Ms. Novak's going to speak about that this evening. there's been a $50 million increase in the Pell Grant program that Minnesota will realize. And there are several bills. This is one bill, and there's a bill later on this evening that are looking to that $50 million as a source of revenue to fund their programs. And so I speak against the funding source, but not against the concept. And I just wanted to be clear about that. That's a good idea. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Or the university kind of weighed in on it, I guess. I don't know if does Minsky itself want to weigh in on this bill in any way, shape, or form? Or would, I guess, we're, is Mr. Thompson or, you know, anyone speaking in behalf of Minsky?
Mr. Chair,
okay. Minsky supports that. Okay, I was just wondering because the chair of Minsky was also the head of the Minnesota Chamber, and the Chamber spoke against it, so I don't know. I was confused as to whether or not the Board of Trustees was supporting this, since the chair of the Board of Trustees as the chair of the Chamber wasn't. Okay, that's all.
We have an amendment which we needed to put on. We didn't have a quorum.
Okay, Representative, Representative Norton moves that House File 3885 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the Higher Education and Workforce Development Omnibus Bill. And then she moves, Representative Norton moves the A1 amendment. Representative Norton,
I could just quickly. This was just some language that the colleges suggested as well as higher ed to make it in a better format, and it's been cleared by everybody and they're fine with an FMI.
Okay, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. To the bill, Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was talking to some of the private colleges this afternoon, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you.
Oh, there you go!
I'm a senator.
That may have been a demotion. Mr. Chair.
Now I can take on the governor. Okay.
Hi, yes. And Representative Norton, so I'm wondering what is the difference is, because I've seen some of the private colleges are already doing this, and there were four colleges together that were doing African, Asian, Spanish, I don't know, different ones together.
Yeah, and I can't speak to the... Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was actually going to address the private-public concern. That public and private were included in last year's bill that was big. This is a pilot, and we need to determine way, way down in order to make this work. And so we did stick with the public college and public school team. The amendment you just put on does have some language that changes be recommended by higher ed next year to broaden the bill and get a different funding source. And I'm very supportive of that. I will say that last year the governor did manage in his bill to get in continued funding for his three programs at St. Thomas. There's three or four colleges. They're all private colleges, and they don't have this program, but they do have smaller programs that do focus on diversity in different ways. So it's not a replication of what they're doing, but they do definitely have, and his was private only.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just kind of interested in how the partnerships were determined.
Thank you for that question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Norton.
We actually sent some higher ed or some human resource guys from the school district to a human resource meeting of a bunch of school districts and said, is anyone else interested in this? I had been working with our local community, Rochester Public Schools and Winona State University, and so they went out, and actually we had several others identified. We just couldn't get them together, so we left it open for two more who are willing to work together on this issue. Robbinsdale stepped forward immediately, saying St. Cloud State and Robbinsdale were interested, and I did hold meetings with those groups together. So there's room for two more, and I think there's definite interest out there.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, if no further questions, Representative Norton then renews her motion that House File 3885, as amended, be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Novak, why don't you remember every bill we have on the agenda tonight deals with our anticipated, or I guess our $15 million from the Pell Grant increase and how it frees up that money, and Ms. Novak's going to explain that to us, and then all of the bills try to spend that money already. So, Ms. Novak.
Mr. Chair, briefly,
The legislature, as you know, last year appropriated money for the state grant program, and we appropriate the amount of money based on an estimate by the Office of Higher Education on the anticipated needs based on the program parameters, the factors that go into calculating the grant awards and how much each student will be eligible to receive. And there's a model that calculates that, and then we here in the legislature, you all, appropriate that amount of money. After the legislature adjourned last year and made the appropriation, the federal government increased the amount of the Pell Grant that each student was eligible for, the maximum amount. The Pell Grant is one of the factors that is used in calculating the state grant award. It's deducted from the amount that a student is eligible for, along with other factors, including the assigned student responsibility and the assigned family responsibility. The Pell Grant comes kind of right off the top. When you make that number bigger, you make the state's share smaller, and you leave more money in the pot. So that's how we end up. That's a very simple explanation, but essentially an adequate one, I believe, of how we ended up with $15 million anticipated. This is anticipated savings to the federal, to the state grant program because of a change that was made by the federal government.
Okay, members, and with that then, Representative Hahn, you want to bring up House File 3365. Representative Hawes moves that House File 3363, be taken off the table, I guess. I don't know if that's the proper motion. And because we had included it for possible inclusion, if you recall, Representative Hawes then wants to take his bill and offer a few amendments. And so Representative Hawes, go ahead, your House File 3363 is back in front of the committee.
Thank you very much, Chair Rucavina, for allowing us to bring back up House File 3363. And I was checking if that works in the rules of Mason. I didn't know that for sure, but it does work in the rules of Robertsky's, which is a Stearns County rules of Roberts.
Rucavina rules.
I appreciate you allowing us to do that and do some work. We're working also on that $15 million, so we should have it pretty well gone if you would like us to do so. The first bill for the First Amendment you'll find in your file is 1330, and that amendment deals with, because the Pell Grant for increase deals with assigned family responsibilities, using a 3% reduction for dependent students, independent students with dependents, and independent students without dependents. And it also deals with tuition maximums for the state grant. And we have our testifier here today, so we will have him introduce himself and explain House File, the amendment for 1330.
Move the 1330 amendment. Does members want to hear about the cost of it, or do they just want to vote on the amendment first? We'll vote on it. Representative Hawes moves the 1330 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Mr. Cannon, Ms. Teagard, whoever's going to take it.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I just have a question. We have a short PowerPoint.
We don't need it.
In the packet, though, that might provide some context if members are interested.
Why don't we just walk through it and tell us what the percentages are going to cost in your estimate, and the I'm assuming that the language changes on the bumps on lines 20 and 2.1 are incorporated in there, but maybe I'm wrong. So why don't you just walk us through it and tell us your estimates on it.
We'll walk through the amendment.
How much money you're eating up? I'm assuming it's $15 million.
So, Mr. Chair, if members are interested...
Before we start, though, there was a rumor going around that the governor was going to actually capture the $15 million, but did he hear about the Kennedy Amendment, so he didn't propose that? Or was that hearsay?
Mr. Chair, I can't speak to that. we had lots of discussions about the $15 million. One of the things that the governor has been doing is working on behalf of the Governors Association with Congress to try, and the National Council of State Legislatures, to try to prevent the maintenance of effort language that's going on at the federal level that would really put some pressure on states. So like his feeling with the budget was to make sure that we protected the $15 million in federal money that was coming to the state. It hasn't increased in a very long time, and so it's a wonderful opportunity for us here. I can't speak to rumors, and I don't know about the Kennedy.
Just wink at me if I was on.
Later.
Okay. Mr. McKenna, you want to walk through it?
I'd wink at you, but it wouldn't be as effective, would it?
No. Mr. Chair, members, the record of Mark and Kennedy, the Office of Higher Education. And I'll just walk through the amendment and decide what it does. And actually, if you did want to refer to that handout, the PowerPoint, it's on page 3, the one at the top kind of describes these features as well. But the change on subdivision 5A, assigned family responsibility, there's two changes there, line 1.7, I'm sorry, 3, 1.7, 1.9, and 1.11. This is a continuation of a change that was made last year in the legislature. There is the assigned family responsibility. It's essentially a rate that is, each family is expected to pay under federal needs analysis. And the case that I guess that we made before you last year was that this is a fairly steep expectation on the part of parents. So to try to mitigate that steepness, these changes do that. This typically affects families between $30,000 and $65,000 of adjusted gross income. This affects both dependent and independent students. And the cost out of the $15 million would be about $4.5 million. That's the first change, Mr. Chair. The second change then occurs on line 1.2 in the amendment, on page 1 there. This is an increase in the tuition maximum, the recognized tuition fee maximum, from $9,838 to $10,133 just in 09 and then ongoing. This is a 3% increase. And you'll see throughout this, Mr. Chair, that there's a consistent 3% number. The change in the assigned family, the tuition caps and LMU later on, is a 3% change. So there's some consistency to the message, essentially. And we're trying to do things because each of these affects different students in different sectors. We're trying to be fair across the board. This change would affect, the first change of the income affects students in all sectors. The second change in the cap affects students at the University of Minnesota and private colleges. The cost of that is about $1.6 million annually. And then the third change is on the top of the next page. Page 2, this is an increase in the LME from $5,900 to $6,077. This again affects students in all sectors. It reflects a 3% increase and costs roughly $5.7 million. Mr. Chair, just to summarize, this still leaves about $3 million left out of the $15 million, and we did that for a couple of reasons. One is there's uncertainty in the economy, and we're not quite sure what's going to happen with increased enrollments. As we've had conversations with the systems, they haven't been able to take that into account yet either. But typically when the economy starts to sour, people go back to school, and the income standard drops. So we'd like to leave a little bit there for that. The other thing is an ongoing, some of the federal changes that aren't reflected in 09 but will be later in 10 and 11 is they've changed the federal needs analysis that will actually cost us some money. We're not quite sure how much that will be yet because we've integrated that in the program. But in 2010-11, we'll have to take that into consideration, so probably wise to leave something on the bottom line as well.
Mr. Chair, my math major is, Mr. Chair, my math major is dates back to about when zero was invented, but I think it's 11.72 million.
Mr. Canis, is the figure on line 1.20 the anticipated use then, which we always use that figure if I'm not mistaken, or is that, as you said, you just did a 3% increase?
No, Mr. Chair, remember that is actually a bit lower. The number we're using for the University of Minnesota, because we use it a little bit different than their quota number because we use it for state grant purposes, but I think it's $10,840, so it's below that by quite a bit.
Okay. And can you tell the committee out of this 11 points, using Representative Hodge math, out of the 11.7, do you know what where it flows for public versus private?
Mr. Chair, on a specific dollar, calculation, I can't say that. I'm not sure.
Would you be able to know that?
Mr. Chair, we're at, and perhaps Mr. Berger's mentioned this, we're at a bit of a disadvantage. The person who did the analysis for our case grant program is no longer with us, so he died about a month and a half ago. So we are unable to do some of the simulations and give you that kind of information that we would have been in the past. So we've been using rules of thumb in order to calculate these numbers, and we've recommended to legislative staff that they do the same thing.
And what would your rule of thumb be on the calculation?
Oh, well, Mr. Chair, we have a rule of thumb on the cost, but not one on the split between public and private for each of these. Mr. Chair, I can do this for the Committee of Information. Look back to some of the changes we made last year in the bill. Reduce the proportions, and I think that would give you a fair analysis.
Okay. All right. Any questions, other questions on the 1330 amendment? Okay. On the 1338 amendment, Representative Hawes moves the 1338 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Amendment adopted. Representative Hawes or
thank
whomever.
You. Thank you very much. Reading through this bill, which was just the amendment was just given me today, but I do believe this is from our bill last year that we worked on called the War, first called War Orphans Act and now called the War Survivors Act, if I'm correct there. And there's a few changes from what we were doing last year. One of the changes was to make students eligible that were two public safety officers killed in the line of duty after January 1st, 1973. And I have a little bit of trouble with that, and our testifier maybe can tell us that, because I thought they were eligible prior to this time. But I could be wrong on that. And also in the extension of for children and all spouses were up above, but also for a dependent child who has been in active military duty for 181 days, which makes them a veteran, they go from 23 to 30. And with that introduction, we will allow our witnesses.
Well, Ms. Grinesman, welcome.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Krista Grinesman from the Office of Higher Education. This is a small program that provides tuition grants to the survivors of safety officers killed in the line of duty, and it affects a small number of students each year. It's currently running about $100,000 a year, and affects, I think, 16 to 20 students a year. Generally speaking, the student is a dependent student until they reach age 24. They're considered dependent. They have to have their parents' income counted in their financial aid eligibility. And so this grant program has been one that cut off at age 24 when the student got to be an independent student. Many children of safety officers seem to be more likely to go into the military. And so the thought was that if they were in the military during the period, during their 18 to 24-year-old years, they might not be able to use the benefit. And by extending it to age 30, a few more students that have parents still in line of duty would be able to benefit. I can't actually answer the question on why the language says January 1, 1973. I've worked at the agency for 22 years, but that one's before my time.
It's probably the starting date that they use for the program. I guess, Ms. Grimes, I'd ask, is there a specific person we're trying to address with the 30 years of age?
Mr. Chair, no. This was a suggestion that one of the veterans on our staff, as he was looking at the language and thinking about how it might work, it was just something we came up with on our own.
And, you know, we've had requests for health insurance and for dependent children going to colleges for grant programs and everything else to increase the age, but we have resisted that because of the cost. Now, I realize this is a much smaller program, but in a question of fairness, I would guess I would ask, would the Office of Higher Education increase support increasing student grant programs to a dependent child who's staying at home with their parents at the age of 30? Mr. Chair, if I may take a crack at that and let my testifiers correct me if I'm wrong, but this is also related to a young man going into the military, and during that time he is celebrating, she is celebrating birthdays, and the potential for using the grant then is being eliminated while they are serving, which doesn't seem to be overly fair.
Mr. Chair, when it comes to the state grant program works differently. For many students, it's to their advantage to not have their parents' income count against them. So becoming an independent student at age 24 actually increases their financial aid eligibility in many cases. So the programs work rather differently.
Okay, any other questions? Do you want the explanation on the back, Ms. Grimes, on the Indian Scholarship Appropriation, just to carry forward? We're not spending that fully, or what's the deal there?
Mr. Chair, in the Indian Scholarship Program, this was our first year of administering that program. The legislature transferred it from the State Department of Education to the Office of Higher Education this year. And we found that there were approximately 830 qualified applicants that applied, and we were only able to fund about 530 of them, so there's roughly 300, a little less than 300 that are on the waiting list. And as you may know, that unfortunately the high school graduation statistics for American Indian students are not a large percentage of them graduate from high school. And here we have a set of Indian students who have graduated from high school, enrolled in college, been accepted and ready to go, and we're not able to fund all of the applicants that are eligible. We have some language here that allows us to transfer among our financial aid programs. If there's a bit of money in one that might not get spent for the end of the year, it'll carry forward, that sort of thing. This would allow us to include the Indian Scholarship Program that could be a recipient, or I suppose if it had excess funds, which it doesn't. It would be among the programs that we can transfer among, and so that would increase our chances of being able to fund the students on the waiting list in 2009 and thereafter.
Well, just a quick question, Mr. Chairman. I think that I think that's a good idea. Maybe it's in the bill, or your assurance that the money that's in that program come next year, when we have another $1.8 million, it's not going to be transferred out. So it's only after that's expended and there's an additional fund balance in another Mr. Chair, we only have half as much money in that program as we need now. So if this were a possible source of additional money for those students, that would be great.
Any other questions for Representative Hobson or the testifier? If not, Representative Hobson, I think the proper motion would be to move then that House File 3363 as amended.
Yeah, amended.
Held over for possible inclusion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Members adopted. Ms. Grimes, before you leave, what is the cost of the dependent child program? Not just this, but is there I suppose it's used once in a while, and what kind of money comes out of it? It's out of the grant program?
Chair, in the past, funding for the Safety Officer Survivor Program was taken out of the overall lump sum for the state grant program, but starting this last year, it was a separate line item. It was $100,000 a year. And we assume that, very, very rough estimate, that there might be 4 to 6 additional students that would qualify because of this change, and that the cost would be about $22,000 a year.
How much?
$22,000 a year.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative,
thank you for your flexibility.
Representative Moe. And we should probably go get files in a... Somebody go get Anne. Larry. Representative Moe moves that... House File 3867 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Higher Education Workforce Development Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also have an amendment, a delete all, that I would like to work from. It's the DE1 amendment.
Representative Moe moves the delete all amendments labeled DE1. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This is an issue that we've all talked about at length. Historically, in the state of Minnesota, we have the responsibility of two-thirds of the cost of student tuition. As you know and you've seen over time, that the cost, in spite of some efforts we made on financial aid, the initial cost for many students, for students has gone to above 50% of the cost of college tuition. The students have brought to my attention a very brilliant piece of legislation to start to move us in the correct direction, Mr. Chair. And I'm sure he's going to support this this bill. that recognizes that right this year we had a difficult time. Well, our budget is not so good, but will move us in that direction and get us to that two-thirds funding target again in 8 years. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to the real author of the bill, Scott Formal, who you see here many times.
Thank you, Representative Moe. Mr. Formal, you may proceed with your testimony on behalf of the bill.
Thank you. Just for the recommending, Ms. Scott Formal, President of the Minnesota State College Student Association. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'd just like to make a couple of real quick comments. First of all, everybody has a written copy of the comments that I was intending to make, but in light of time tonight, I'd like to make some very brief comments and just refer you to the memo itself. But I just want to take just a moment real quickly to recognize the fact that the Minnesota Board of Trustees has recognized this even prior to the start of the legislative session last year, that the tuition increases at our colleges and universities has been an issue that they've looked to address. And even when they were preparing their budget request for this current session, they had taken a position that they were going to limit that, or attempt to limit the tuition increase to 4% at our colleges and universities for both years of each year of the biennium. Since the adjournment of the last legislative session, we continue to have conversations with the Board of Trustees, and right now we've asked them to see if they can do better than that 4% commitment in light of the appropriations that they received last year. And the current discussions that have gone on with the board is that they're going to reallocate $9 million from the system budget to buy down tuition at our two-year colleges from 4% down to 2%, and at the state universities down to a 3% level. And with that being said, under normal circumstances, we would have liked to have had the final decision from the board prior to this legislation moving forward, but the board is scheduled to take this up next week. That amount may or may not change depending on their resolution and depending on the final resolution of balancing the state's budget. But we would hope that this bill, you know, as the legislature, we would hope that you would look to this bill as affirming their decision to reallocate funds and try to do better for our colleges and universities with respect to tuition within the budget. And then also reaffirm your commitment to trying to reestablish that two-thirds, one-third model over the next 8 years. And I will leave my comments to that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Formal, and I must commend you on behalf of, on the work that you do on behalf of all of the students. We see you up here at the Capitol often, and I know that you're taking time out of your schedule. So thank you on behalf of the student. And Representative Moe, do you have another testifier?
In front of you, we do.
Would you please identify yourself for the record?
Yes, my name is Kara Brock, and I'm the state chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association. I'll also be very brief. I just want to echo the sentiments that my colleague from MSCSA has made regarding tuition. We would like to commend the Board of Trustees from MSU on the efforts that they have done in helping control tuition increases, especially in the past couple of years with a 4% cap last year and the proposed 3% cap for universities this year and 2% cap for the colleges and technical schools. And we would just like to see the legislature reaffirm their effort to continue to fund higher education and put a control on some of the tuition increases we've seen over the past year. So, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brocken. Are there any questions for either Mr. Formal or Ms. Brocken? Are there any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Moe, do you have any other testifiers on behalf of this bill?
No, we don't, Mr. Chairman. Just a brief parting comment. We had made a historical effort in this committee last year to hold down tuition.
And what this bill now, as amended, is just reaffirming that motion in the correct direction and using that as the stepping stone for us to get back to the two-thirds model. I think putting this in statute will be a nice target for us then to come back next year and to continue to work in this direction. So I appreciate the committee and the chairman's support.
All right. Thank you, Representative. Are there any individuals in the audience that would like to testify either for or against this bill? Anyone in the audience that wishes to testify? All right. Seeing none. Representative Moe renews his motion that House File 3867 pass as amended and be held over for possible inclusion in the Higher Education and Workforce Development Policy and Finance Division omnibus bill. All those in favor state by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, nay. Motion passes. All right. Next, we will hear from Representative Atkins.
This reminds me, Mr. Chair, what I used to do when I was taking depositions of people, and I would ratchet my chair all the way up so I was high, and I'd take the witness's chair and I'd ratchet all the way down. Well, I'm sitting in this little chair over here, but in any event,
I ratcheted it down when I left.
Was that what you did?
What your point is?
All right, Chair. Representative Atkins moves to House File 1142.
Who we have to work with?
They're always ratcheted down in my case, so.
And Mr. Chair, if it pleases the Chair, I would offer the A1 amendment to put it into the shape in which the author would like to proceed with the bill.
Okay. Representative Atkins moves the 1142 A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? Any discussion? Any discussion? See, no further discussion. We'll move to vote on the A1 amendment. All those in favor, of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, nay. All right. Motion is adopted, or amendment is adopted.
Thank you.
All right. Moving on. Do you have another amendment, or was that?
No, we had two different amendments. We opted to offer the A1, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, Representative Atkins, you can proceed to give us the testimony on the file as the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1142, as amended, is with respect to the state grant program. This is the program, folks, that we use that puts money directly towards students, which every study I've ever seen has said that's where it is best spent and has the most impact. The goal of this legislation at the 44% level is that it gives the most help that we can afford to do. There's about, as I understand, I believe $15 million that's available that is designated for this sort of use, puts the money in the students' hands, and decreases their need to rely on other forms of aid and loans and all of the things that we always preach about trying to do our best to avoid. With that, I do have two testifiers that will walk you through the merits of this bill. One is Mark Chronister from the Minnesota Private College Council, and then also Charmaine Bell. I knew that Chairman Rukavina likes to hear from students, and so I wanted to make sure that we had a student who also happens to be a state grant recipient, and we're very proud to have her here tonight, Mr. Chairman. So with that, I will turn to Mark and to Charmaine.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. Mark and Charmaine, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record, and you can proceed with your testimony.
Hi, I'm Charmaine Bell. I'm a first-year student from Augsburg College. I am also an education major. I'm trying to be a writing teacher. This state grant means a lot to me. If it wasn't for the state grant, I wouldn't be at Augsburg or in college at all. I was in a program called Admission Possible. I didn't think about college until my senior year of high school. They basically told me about the grants, the scholarships, all the opportunities I had in order to get to Augsburg. I'm worried that if more money isn't being put into it, I'm not going to see my sister go to college. She's only 15. Because of this grant, I had the option to choose where I wanted to go. I didn't have to go to the U or to a bigger school. I needed that small class size in order to do good. I'm doing really, really well in school right now. I like being able to be in a small community
I just really wish that, or hope that this money goes into this grant. Let's see what else here. Sorry, I'm a little nervous. My first time being here. And also, being an educator, I want to be a teacher. Once I get out of school, I'm going to have to be burdened with a lot of bills from the loans, you know. I took out a lot of loans, even though I received the grant, and it helped me a lot with this, with my tuition at Augsburg. I still had to take out a lot of loans, Perkins and Stafford, and I'm just worried that if more money isn't being put into this grant, that I'll really have a lot to pay back once I'm an educator, I'm a teacher, when I should be more worried about educating my students and helping them get farther in their education.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Bell, for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mark Cronister. I'm a board member of the Minnesota Private College Council and also chair of the Public Policy Committee. And I'd like to take just a minute to talk about what happened in getting this Pell increase of $15 million. It was over a six-year effort by Congress, including our own congressional delegation, who worked very hard on this to secure funds as a recognition of a greater investment in our need-based funding for higher education. The advocacy for this increase came not only from private but public institutions across the nation. And the Pell increase came, again, because of a bipartisan effort that Congress that developed over the six-year time period. From the viewpoint of the business community, this investment in Minnesota helped create and keep the educated workforce that Minnesota needs to grow our economy and remain, if not increase, our competitiveness globally. We continue to face in Minnesota challenges due to our ever-changing demographics. This investment will help bring more students into higher education by continuing to remove financial barriers. And finally, our state's competitiveness is based on an extremely well-educated citizenry. If we want to maintain that competitive edge, we need to make sure we're doing everything we can to educate our students and give them the skills necessary to participate and grow in our economy. Currently, there are 81,000 students that benefit from our state grant program. The dollars benefit the students and allow them to choose what college they would like to attend that best fits their needs. The benefit of this investment goes to students and therefore follows them to public and private institutions. The increase in the Pell Grant will allow us to reduce the amount of loans that Charmaine talked about and help make college affordable and increase the number of students that will be able to go to school. In the last 15 years, the total amount of student loans has increased fourfold, and now for a Minnesota student is in excess of $1 billion. So in conclusion, the other ideas and programs are well intended, but we believe they should not come at the expense of our current state grant program. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cronister. Members, do you have any questions for either of the testifiers, Mr. Cronister or Ms. Bell?
Here.
Representative Rukumi.
Representative Actions, I imagine you're here.
Representative Rukumi.
Representative Actions, I imagine you're using up most of the $15 million with the reduction.
Mr. Chair, every last drop. That was, I just follow your direction, Mr. Chair, and you always manage to grab as much as you possibly can.
And
one point, and this is important to make, that this raises all ships. It's both for public and private college kids, and it's directly to the students. I love the institutions. I've always supported their bills, but the best way to help the student is to directly help the student.
But it's approximately $15 million. And Chair Atkins, or maybe for the office hired Jason or somebody, Ms. Canis, what would be, you know, what the breakdown and split would be between the public and private colleges?
Mr.
Canis?
Mr. Chair and members, it's active of benefits students of all sectors.
I know that.
In response to your earlier question, we can put together some analysis that all the bills that you saw tonight, and that kind of
stuff. Representative Green, any follow-up questions? All right. Any other questions from the members?
I just maybe for the Representative Green, Bell, is it? Welcome to the committee. It's nice to have you here. And are you a freshman? Or?
Yes, I am.
And so far, did the grant program take care? Do you have any personal debt, or is it
basically helping pay for everything.
The majority of it, my tuition is paid by the state grant.
Seeing no further questions, thank you to the two of you for joining this committee. We appreciate your testimony.
Thanks.
Representative Atkins, do you have any further testifiers?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, sure. Are there any members in the audience that wish to testify either for or against this bill? All right, Ms. Smith? All right, Representative Mahoney, do you have a question?
I do, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. There is one additional testifier. I misunderstood an earlier comment that the testifier had made. My apologies.
Okay. Ms. Smith.
Thank you. Real quick, just for the record, my name is Stacey Smith, again, with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I would just like to testify in support of Representative Atkins' bill. Again, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce supports any growth to the state grant program.
Right, and thank you, Ms. Smith, for your comments.
Thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Atkins, how come you never have any testifiers in your own committee?
Representative Atkins.
I don't need any, Representative Mahoney, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Okay.
You want to be
honest? I'm done with all my bills.
Are there any other individuals that wish to testify for or against the bill?
Mr. Chair.
All right, seeing no further testifiers, Representative Rukavina.
Well, but in his committee is still usually passed, and that may not be the case tonight.
I'm voting for the chair's committee.
I have a good feeling about this one, Mr. Chair. Any further questions for Representative Atkins? All right, seeing no further questions, Representative Atkins renews his motion that House File 1142 pass as amended and be held over for possible inclusion in the Higher Education Workforce Development Policy and Finance Division Omnibus Bill. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Motion carries. The bill is laid over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Member.
You're welcome, Representative Atkins.
Representative Welty moves the... let's see, Representative Carlson's... The House File 3794 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the Higher Education Workforce Development Omnibus Bill. Welcome to the committee, Representative Carlson. It's nice to have you in front of my committee since I have to go in front of yours all the time.
Well, I'm enthralled with the opportunity and, I was sitting there trying to remember, but I probably spent, 25 years or something like that. I'll have to calculate that sometime on this committee. So going back to about 1979, 1980. So it is a high interest area of mine. But Mr. Chairman, I do have several people that are here to testify and show their support, including some students. So I do have a few introductory comments that I would like to make, Mr. Chairman, and if it's all right, then we have some of the college presidents and other staff who will quickly comment, and then we have a number of students that have been impacted by the current Power of You program.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, this committee, we always like to hear from the students rather than the bureaucrats and the administrators. But we'll let the bureaucrats and administrators have a very short presentation, and then the students can.
And Representative Rukavina, you and I talked earlier today, and you told me of your interest in students, and that's why I indicated that the presidents would be short. But if you'd like the students to go first, that would be fine.
No, we'll let the presidents and administrators go short. They can be as short as I am, and then we'll let the students.
Well, I'll get started then, Mr. Chairman. Members, we know that Minnesota's economy has been built on our skilled workforce, and these workers are the products of our tremendous public education system. For past generations, a high school diploma indicated an individual had all of the education necessary to be hired for a well-paying job. But in today's economy, for most workers, the high school diploma is not enough. The bill before you today moves us toward our state providing a public education after high school graduation. The bill provides ongoing funding for the existing Power of You program and explains the program for three additional pilots to be determined in the suburban and rural areas. The Power of You program at Metropolitan State University, Minneapolis Community Technical College, and St. Paul College provides for the first 2 years of college free for graduates of St. Paul and Minneapolis Public High Schools who are residents of either city. This program was started with the commitment from a number of foundations and corporations for a five-year pilot. This fall, the schools are admitting their final class supported by private contributions. House File 3794 provides for a $2 million transfer of funds from the Pell Savings to continue this proven program. While this proposal uses Pell Savings, it is simply reposing the resources for a different approach to financial aid. So that's one thing I want to underscore. We are keeping it within the financial aid program. Representatives from the three colleges will be speaking in more detail about the program and its outcomes shortly. The second portion of the bill provides for three pilot programs to determine if similar results that you'll be hearing about that can be achieved in suburban and rural areas. Similarly, it provides a $2 million transfer from the Pell Savings to fund these pilot programs. This is not the first time I have worked to provide an opportunity for free public college. In 1997, I brought a similar bill forward, as unfortunately was removed in a conference committee. As we are facing an economic downturn, we know that one of the best ways to grow our way out of this is through a well-educated workforce. In the last 25 years, Minnesota has not seen a significant change in the proportion of high school grads going on to college. While many experts, including the Private College Council, are predicting a serious looming worker shortage unless we increase our college-going population. This bill will test whether providing the first year or two of college free will increase college participation among underrepresented groups, which will provide these students the opportunity to achieve a higher wage job. Now more than ever, it is critical that we are ensuring all of our state students have the opportunity to advance their education and be prepared to carry out our state's economy through the 21st century. I have today the President Donovan Schlichtenberg of the St. Paul College, Beverly Turner, the Vice President for Governmental Relations at Travelers Company, and Michael Faber, the Principal at Robbinsdale Cooper High School. And I would like to mention that we do have other people available to answer questions as well from the systems and from the business community and from Mayor Chris Coleman's office. So I'd like to turn it over, Mr. Chairman, to Donovan Schlichtenberg with the St. Paul College Board. I think the chair has just reached out.
Very fine, thank you. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Chair, I'm Donovan Schlichtenberg, President of St. Paul College. In the recognition of the short period of time, I'm also representing Bill Lowe, the interim president of Metropolitan State University, and Phil Davis, the president of Minneapolis Community Technical College this evening. Together, our three institutions established the Power of You to increase the college and university participation and graduation of low-income students and students of color in response to the real and perceived beliefs that they could not afford to go to college. The program is important for three reasons. First, the program will increase the number of skilled workers that are going to be available to our businesses. Second, the increased skills gained by the students will allow the individuals to command better salaries to support themselves and their future families. And third, and most importantly, the Citizens League report of 2004 attracted our attention with a prediction that of 100 ninth graders in school that year, only 3% of the African American and American Indian students and 5% of Latino students would earn a bachelor's degree in Minnesota by the time they were 25. We believe that the American dream should be shared by all citizens. We did not come to the legislature and ask for economic support for this program. We felt that by telling you to build it and they will come, it sounded too hollow. Instead, we decided that we should first demonstrate success. So we contacted many wonderful companies in Minnesota, 3M, Medtronic, General Mills, and foundations, and raised almost $4 million to fund the Power of You program.
As we approached them, we knew that this could not be a forever program related to their funding, but again believed that the results would demonstrate to policymakers like you that a public investment in the Power U would be good for Minnesota. We started the program in 2006 and took our first cohort in. The maximum amount of money was used to fund the gap between what the students were eligible for the financial aid, and what they actually received, about $1,100 per student to send these over 300 students to college. We also had two other components that were important to success of the program. One was the support services, which is some advising and counseling, and also specialized courses to help to be sure they're successful. And then a reach back component to help make sure that families and children had a chance to plan for the future, knowing that they would be able to go to college, and it was possible, not only possible, but essential. We engaged the Wilder Foundation to conduct an independent evaluation of the program, and we believe the first year has been very outstanding. Their report indicated that we doubled the recent number of high school graduates who enrolled in our schools without having a negative effect on enrollment of the other Minnesota colleges. We enrolled 357 students in the original cohort. Their report also indicated that of these 357, 76% were students of color. The median household was less than $30,000. 30% said of the students said they were not planning to go to college and would not have attended without the Power of U. Of the remaining group, 80% said the Power of U significantly influenced their decision to attend college. And 85% completed their first year and returned for a second year, which was higher than our traditional cohort of returning students. This is a program that is working, and we also have some information we'll pass out to you related to the report that the Wilder Foundation had given us.
Questions, the committee? Thank you.
I would like, if it would be possible, the principal of Cooper High School certainly come forward maybe at this point. He brings a unique perspective, Mr. Chairman. He is...
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Quistenberg?
I hate to interrupt the chair of one of my committees, but I have to leave to go to vote on another committee, and I wanted to make sure I stayed to hear the chancellor from St. Paul College, because I've actually been over to the college and we had a couple of conversations. This is really a wonderful, wonderful program, and if there's a way we can make this happen this year for the kids that this helps, and having met some of those kids, it is really kind of, we don't get to smile and think how fun some of the things that we do up here. This is one of the programs that we get to smile and think how fun to do this for kids. So I applaud you for doing it, and if Mr. Huntley's medical bill is done, I'll be back to vote on this one. So, yes.
Sir, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Favor, I was about to say, brings a unique perspective because he was formerly the principal of North High School in Minneapolis, and recently went to work for the Robbinsdale Schools and as the principal at Cooper. And one day his name appeared on my agenda, and he came over to talk about the Power of U program and his interest in seeing it as an opportunity to be provided for a broader number of students, namely in the suburbs. And I don't think when he came over he had any idea that this was an issue that I had been working on. I think in my notes they said 97, really since about 91 or 92. So it's been a high interest area of mine for a long time, but if it would be all right for him to make a few comments.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Faber. If you just identify yourself.
Thank you, sir. My name is Mike Faber. I'm currently the principal at Robbinsdale Cooper High School, and I will be brief with my comments. I've had a wonderful opportunity to see the Power of U in action. Above and beyond what it does for kids, it does some extremely wonderful things for educators. It allows us to meet with schools like MCTC, Metro State, and begin to articulate curriculum that only strengthens what we do in the building and ready our students for college. It allows us to clearly understand, and working closely with the college, to understand what it takes at the high school level to ready kids at the college level. We ask for specific outcomes that they're looking for the bare minimum, at a bare minimum, our kids are working towards those outcomes. While I was at North High School, one of the things that this program did was create a tremendous amount of hope and energy around learning. Sometimes our students need to be reminded that you're getting good grades for a reason, and some of those reasons are the opportunities, much like the power of you, to become a part of. And then also I'd just like to say, it really helped us with our mobility rates. We have a number of kids that are constantly moving in and out of the building. This helped us stabilize some of the mobility because kids wanted to stay with North High School, and now potentially my hope is Cooper High School, so that they can stay and continue to be a part of a program like the Power View. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Faber?
I don't know if this is the breakfast ask, but maybe, or maybe even the author. Can you tell me what percentage of American Indian kids are participating in this program?
We probably can get those figures from the MCTC in St. Paul. And,
yeah. Thank you.
We can get those for you.
We'll have to check. I was just told that 76% of the students are students of color, but the list that I have sure doesn't happen to have Native American listed with any other groups.
Okay. Ms. Faber, thank you. Ms. Turner, welcome to the committee. I haven't had the pleasure of having you in front of my committee. It's nice to see you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Beth Turner, Travelers Company, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of the Power of You program on behalf of the Travelers Company. Travelers is a leading property casualty insurer. We're headquartered in downtown St. Paul. We're very active in the communities where we do business. It's important for us to stay engaged where our employees live and work. We are very committed to the Power of You program, increasing access to higher education and providing underrepresented students with the opportunity to excel. The Power of You program strongly fits with our Education Access Initiative focus under our foundation and its objectives, and Travelers is a major contributor to the Power of You program. And I'll give you a few of the reasons why. The demographic changes indicate that the largest population increase will come from communities currently underrepresented in educational institutions. And students from these communities are the workforce of tomorrow. We believe that our business benefits from the ability to recruit from a diverse pool of talented candidates. The world is diverse and our customer base is diverse as well. The Power of You program also complements the Insurance Institute within the Business School of Metro State that we began funding this year. And we are providing somewhat of an exchange program where we have Travelers employees go over to the school to educate students and inform them about programs that we have and career opportunities for them at Travelers. And we also are in the process of providing opportunities for internships for those students, as well as career opportunities for employment after they graduate. In addition, and as I said, we expect that they will have potential employment and internship opportunities with our company. In summary, the Power of You program not only benefits the community, but it makes good business sense for a corporation such as Travelers. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Turner, are there other companies participating besides Travelers in that?
Mr. Chairman, there are several corporations that have provided funding for the Power of You company. I know some of our fellow insurance companies, such as Securian, has been active. I don't have the rest of the list, but I'm sure someone here does.
And the private businesses, what's the total amount of their contribution to this? Or what was it to the current Power of You program at MCTC and St. Paul and Metro? Mr.
Chair,
We were very, very appreciative of the contributions made by many companies, including 3M, Medtronic, General Mills. Travelers was the pioneer company that came out and helped with General Mills. And we've collected almost $4 million at this time, and we are still raising funds, and we have some other commitments that are pending out there for financing this particular program.
That's really impressive. Is that then, is any type of endowment envisioned, or just spend as you receive it?
Mr. Chair, at this time, we've been raising funds to finance the program. It was meant as a demonstration project. We knew that it would have a beginning and probably have an end because companies are not going to support the program forever. We felt that we demonstrated the success of the program, that we could show to our policymakers that the intent of the program was excellent and it did have a future implication for funding for the benefit of the state of Minnesota.
Other questions from the committee members? Does the Office of Higher Education have a...
Mr. Chairman, if I may, you indicated an interest in hearing from some students.
Well, we want to definitely hear from
the
students.
Would you like to hear from them before we conclude the...
Oh, I'm definitely going to hear from the students. Okay. They're the most important reason why we're here.
That's right, and
that's the only reason we're always here, is because of students. But I was just wondering if the... Office of Higher Education.
I just wanted to make sure you were aware that we have at least two students who would like to testify.
Oh, I hope all 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of them testify, but we'll see. But anyway, we don't want to put anybody on the spot.
There are two in particular that indicated that.
But I wanted to know if the Office of Higher Education has an opinion on this, or if the Governor's Office has an opinion on the program.
Mr. Chair and members, Susan Heathard with the Office of Higher Education. I talk fast, you know that. This program, I've met a number of the students in this program. I've been to a couple of their various celebrations. You know, it's an innovative, very clear, it's very innovative. The public-private partnership is wonderful. I think what they've made it very clear to students, the message is very clear. If you finish, you know, high school in the Twin Cities, you get to go to college for free, and I think that clear messaging has been very effective. The questions I think that our office has is really this issue of expanding statewide. What are some of the implications of doing that? One is that it really raises this question, the philosophical question of should the first year or two of college be free, completely free to students? And it's just a question I think that members need to wrestle with. The second is another philosophical question, and we've really always argued that financial aid ought to stay central, and then it gets parceled out depending upon the student's choice of institution. So what we're beginning to see is that pieces of the grant program begin to get parceled off to particular sectors or, you know, public versus private institutions, and that's another question that we have. The third question, I think, is if there's a shortfall in the program now, if the program's not fully funded, if you expand it statewide, does that issue of shortfall persist? My understanding is that the financial aid is packaged, and then the private money fills in behind that, and that's been effective to some extent. But it sounds like there's some shortfall. And my question, I guess, for some of the folks here is, so what happens when you expand it statewide? You know, is it sustainable? And then there was just a fourth point. I know that Minsky got about $22 million, I think, over the biennium for underserved students. And my question, and I don't think we got this answered by the folks that we contacted, was there any use of that funding for the Power of You program? I don't know if there was or wasn't. I know that there was a list of things that they wanted to use that money for. So, again, you know, our question is really about the use of the funding and sort of this question about the shortfall and whether that will persist if the program expanded statewide. Thanks.
Thank you. And then Representative Carlson, would you like to hear if there's any opposition first before we bring the students, or should we wait?
Whatever order you'd like, Mr. Chairman. I would like to point out that the previous testifier, I do want to clarify one thing. The program is not going statewide. It would have two pilots in the rural area, two pilots in the suburban area, and then continue the funding in Minneapolis and St. Paul for the current program. Many years ago, I had a program that would have gone statewide, but we're currently working with pilots.
The students, then, why don't we bring them down? And if just a couple of you want to testify, that's fine.
And and two that are going to testify, maybe to
right.
Chair, and that's Shanita and Miracle.
Why don't you all come down and just tell us your names if you want, and then the two testifiers can go ahead and
the others can have sit down at the show to support in the interest of time. But
yes. Welcome, all of you. So go ahead and sit down and pull up a couple of those chairs, our cases, if we can. They need a few more. Welcome to the committee. Why don't you just identify yourself as you begin to speak?
Well, my name is Nicole Samuel, and I'm majoring in physical therapy, and this is my second year at St. Paul College.
Thank you. Tom?
My name is Miracle Ehiman, and I'm under the AA transfer system, and I'm planning on transferring to Concordia at St. Paul, and I will be going for social work.
Thank you.
My name is Kanita Dangerfield. My major is pediatrician. It's my second semester at NCTC.
Thank you.
How do you do, Mr. Chairman? My name is Donald Cummings, and I'm going to Minneapolis Community Technical College for screenwriting.
Thank you all very much. And who is going to be speaking next? You don't have to be shy in front of this.
Well,
Ms. Dangerfield, do you want to start?
Well, the Power View program, it not only has helped me, but it has helped others because, you know, you have to do civic engagement, and I have been working with younger kids at Wyndham, and they look up to me as a role model. So this program, like at NCTC, we do like Connect Day, and we have to get in front of like students, not like y'all, but like in front of students and talk about the Power of You, and they just be so excited, like, oh, they can have to go 2 years at NCTC, oh, that's nice. So it's just, when you hear the Power of You, they just be so excited, and that's what, in 2006, when I first heard about it, I was just like, I gotta jump on it, and it wasn't even that close, like, it was so far when y'all had first started this, it wasn't even around the time, so I just jumped up on it when I heard about it. I'm nervous, so I'm so sorry.
That's okay. You don't have to be nervous. And you came from Minneapolis school system and attended and are attending MCTC now.
Yes, I graduated from
Okay. And who then is the other testifier? Don't be shy in front of this committee. You know, I need role models, so you kids, it's great to have you here.
My name is Miracle again, and I would like to say that the Power of You has really helped us all in different ways, because when I look into my family, I have an older brother and an older sister, and academically we're up there, but after my older brother got it from college, from high school, he went to the University of Duluth, and he came back home after 2 years because of finance, the family, it's a big family, and it's not enough, you know, economic, you know, coming in the house, and so be able to put money here and there, it's really difficult. So when I look at that, and then I see myself in the higher education at St. Paul College, and I'm able to walk in there, get my studies done, and go back home, I feel really proud. And it's been very, very helpful, and I'm really grateful. And if I was President Dunn, and I was sitting in your chair, I would be doing the same thing, because, like they said, the African-American students, the Latinos, if you look around today, you don't see most of them actually pursuing that higher education. Even some of them will even drop out of high school, maybe thinking that, okay, well, if I'm done with high school, what's going to come out of it? I'm not even going to go to college anyway, so why not just, you know, drop out? So I would really you know, like to plead on everyone's behalf. And like she was doing program, I was also doing some volunteering programs for the Power View once before, and the program is called Choosing to Achieve. And I have to go to elementary schools and, you know, be like a mentor, you know, to those students. And then I see most of them with good skills and big dreams. But then I look around, I'm like, okay, well, if the hand is not there, how are they going to reach those dreams? So when I first gave a speech for the Power View Foundation, I think last year, I said this before, that we are like students who want to reach up there, but this program has given us the upper hand to pull us out. So I will really plead on everyone's behalf to put this on the statewide funding, you know, because it's really doing a great thing. You know, when I was in high school, I know I used to dress in jeans, but, you know, one of the things that comes to mind now is that I dress up in suit and tie every day to school, because, you know, I feel like I'm in the upper hand now. You know, when people ask me, oh, how many credits are you taking? I'm like 14, 15, and they're like, wow, how are you paying for college? I'm not really paying for anything. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it brings the joy and it brings the motivation. So, like I said, please, I beg on everyone, whatever you can to help out so that this can also be passed on. I once told the director of Power View, when I first joined the program, I said, you know what? If this program can help me go to school and don't have to worry about that whole money thing, that whole money issue, I'm going to come back and do this someday for everyone. So please, let's try to work together and do this for the students so we can also do it for others. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You were a little shy at starting, but you finished strong. I'll tell you that much. You're going to be a politician someday, you know that? And you live in, are you from St. Paul then?
Yes, I am.
And I hope Representative Mahoney, you don't live in his district, because I think you beat him, but, you know. But anyway, do any of the other two students want to say anything? Okay. Well, any questions of the students at all? Okay. Representative Plumlee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I commend you for what you're doing, being students and going on for higher education. I think that's great. I have a question just about the summer. If you, is it just the academic year that you are in school? Is there any support services or other education that you're receiving during the summer, either ahead of your freshman year or as you are going from your freshman year to your sophomore year, your first to second year?
Are you all in the same position on that? Or? Yes. Go ahead.
From high school to college?
Yes, either from high school to college or from, maybe you're still all in your first year, so you don't know if there's anything between first and second year.
Are you going full-time or are you, and even in summer?
No, mm-hmm. Full-time, I'm a student, and then summer, last summer, I took some credit too.
Okay. Mr. Cummings or Ms. Dangerfield? Mr. Cummings?
Again, my name is Donald Cummings. You talking about like a summer program?
Yeah, if there's an additional summer program or if you're taking summer credits.
Yeah, they said, my counselor said that there may be some summer classes. It just depends. Like, I may have to take a summer class, like just one class for, you know, like a few credits so I can get my credits up and stuff.
Okay.
Now, did any of you get to work during the summer, let's say, or do the internships that Ms. Turner talked about that were offered at Travelers and maybe some of the other businesses that are participating? Or haven't you gotten to that point yet?
No, we haven't gotten to that point yet. Maybe we'll probably get to that.
Well, listen, we appreciate you being here because, as I said, this committee, you know, the whole higher education system exists because of you students. And I am glad that it's working for you, and I hope a program like this can continue. Yes, Mr. Cummings. No, good. You were a slow starter too. We want to go ahead.
Are you Keeley? Like I said, my name is Donald Cummings, and I'm majoring in screenwriting as my major at MCTC for Minneapolis Community Technical College. And I basically found out about the Power U program from a community center I was going to, El Rio Vista, down in West St. Paul. And I found out about from this lady. She came up to me and she said, well, I know you're graduating from high school soon, so there's this Power U program, and they can get you into college for free, and you can take, 2 years there and take get college credits and stuff. And at first, I thought about it because I didn't really know, because throughout my whole years of high school, I felt that college would be too hard for me. I couldn't do it. I wouldn't be able to succeed, because a lot of people I knew said, oh, man, you shouldn't do college. It's not really good for you. But then after a while, I learned from some people, some mentors I have, some mentors of mine. They taught me about how if you do want that higher education, you're going to have to go to college to be able to get a successful career and to get a good job and stuff like that, and to be able to gain more knowledge and stuff so you can keep on and pass it on to others. So I went to Minneapolis Community Technical College. I walked around there, and I liked it from the start, so I applied and had to fill out financial aid papers and stuff. And that was a long process, but I worked through it with my drive. So I worked through that. I handed it in, and I got a call back, got my acceptance letter, and I came in to the orientation, and I really connected with the counselors that we have there. It's a very nice and friendly atmosphere that we have here, that we have at MCTC. Like I felt in high school, where it was that the teachers really didn't care about me as far as to learn things, because they were just, like in my high school, I went to Humboldt High School, and I went there and I felt like they didn't really care about us, because they gave us, a math class, they'll just give us a textbook, throw it at us and say, okay, open this page here, read this, that's it. They maybe teach you little bitty bits and pieces of what you need to learn, but they really wouldn't teach you anything. But I feel like it's here, since it's like hands-on learning and stuff, and they really give you, if you really need that extra help, you can just go and ask them for that extra help that you need. And I feel that I'm not just going to college for myself, I'm going for my whole community and for my whole family, because like the reason I'm in this program is so I can succeed in life and then pass my success and teach and give knowledge on to others of what I learned, because I know there's a lot of smart people in my community and in other high schools I went to, and they're completely smart. They are so smart, but the problem is that they can't go to college because they don't have any money. Their parents have low incomes, and a lot of people, fathers aren't around and stuff to provide money for the family to be able to go to college and succeed and get that higher education and stuff. So there are a lot of people who are smart out there, but they don't have enough, they don't have money to be able to go on and go to college and be able to gain more knowledge from that. And I feel that, like I said, the reason why I'm in college, I want other people to succeed and stuff and pass my knowledge on to others and stuff. And it's just, basically, the Power U program is just a joy to me, because I wouldn't be in this program right now if this lady wouldn't have told me about it and stuff, because I want to be able to succeed and want to be able to become what I want to be and do what I want to do. And so be able to, the Power U program makes me able to push myself to have that drive to succeed, to be successful in life, and knowing that nothing can stop me but myself. That's why I think it's called the Power U program, because it gives you the drive within yourself to be able to succeed in life and be able to accomplish your dreams and goals without anybody telling you that you can't. Because that's what a lot of people hear, like in high school and stuff, a lot of teachers tease, quote, students to, you won't be able to do this, you can't be able to do that. That's what happened to me. I'm not speaking for any of the other students here. That's just personal with my experience from high school and stuff. So, but basically, I think Power U program is a program that is very great for students, and it will give students that drive to get to be able to grab hold of the success that they want and to achieve their lifelong goals and dreams or whatever they want to accomplish without anything stopping them, with money issues and stuff like that. And I feel like this program is also useful, is because a matter of, I would never take out a loan. I will not in my whole life take out a loan, because I know a lot of people who are going off loans in college, and they are 25, 26, and they got their own house, but then they have to keep paying off these loans and stuff. They use credit cards and got loans from banks, and they have to keep paying this off for all these years, and they get depressed and stuff. So I will never, ever in my life take out a loan. So that's why I feel like this program is good for me, so I can be able to go to college and succeed and do my classes and stuff without having to worry about, you know, getting depressed because I have to pay off this money that I owe the bank or something like that. So that's why I feel like this program is also helpful and useful. So, thank you.
Mr. Cummings, I just have to tell you, I think you not only just made your family proud and your community proud, but I think all the people that have been in participating as far as you are pretty proud, smiling behind you. So you did a really good job. And I hope you don't move to the range, because you're a pretty good politician. Ooh, you've gone up on a roll there. So. Questions of the students? Representative Coffey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And once again, congratulations. You've shown courage and strength, and you are doing awesome things, and that's wonderful. And I think as a future screenwriter, perhaps you can get started just writing a commercial, The Power of You, and being able to do a mini-series or something. And based on what you've been talking about, you're very exciting. You're very passionate about what you're doing, and that's to be congratulated. So thank you for sharing.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chair Lukavina, and to the four of you, just quickly. Can you tell me, do you have a plan? Because I'm understanding this program, they pick up your first 2 years. But then after that, do any of you get 4 years free? But if you don't, I'm just wondering, do you have a plan for those of you who want to go on beyond 2 years of how you're going to pay for your tuition?
Any of you want to tackle that? Sure, go ahead.
Not to my knowledge that the Power U program pays for the next 2 years, but my plan was is that after these 2 years are over, I could basically, like, because during the summer I do work and stuff like that, so be able for me to, like, once the summer comes and save up money, or because they do have some, they have this one, I forgot what it was, but there was this one person, I think he's an ex-football player or something, his deadline is in May, to fill out to type up this paper to explain why you're in college and why you want to be able to go on and succeed in college and stuff like that, and what are you doing in college, and just basically fill that out, and he'll loan, he'll give you, I think it was $1,000 or something like that. So, but basically what my plan was is to, like, when these 2 years are up and I get my associate's degree, I wanted to be able to transfer or go to Metropolitan State to be able to take 2 more years so I can get my bachelor's in screenwriting. But not to my knowledge that the program gives you like 2 years. I don't.
Any of you other students want to weigh in on that?
Yeah. I think to my best knowledge so far was that things are program right now, from what I know, is within St. Clair College and Metropolitan and another school. Yeah. So what I once was told was that after this 2 years, when they look at the budget they have for students, you know, individual students, and you want those, they could still help you out if you were transferred from either St. Clair College or MCC to Metropolitan State University. So that is what I believe the program have for now for the students as individuals. And then, but then as for a plan on our side, I personally say for me, I am working, I'm doing my best to try to get some other scholarship out there that could be available. Like right now, I just received a letter from the PPK scholarship program, and I've been accepted there. And so that comes to play, I think most of that comes to play on our side too, to do well in school academically, because most scholarships out there, we be ranging from students who have a qualified GPA of about 3.4 or 3.5, and that was how I got a TPK scholarship. And then also some universities out there that may cost a lot of money to go to, if you also have those good qualified GPA, they might have scholarships there to so. And then also my plan also was to my uncle told me about this program where that is really good for college students like me and everyone here, that if you work for them and then you don't really get paid, they just give you like a stipend, and then when you're done, if you complete a whole year, you know, if you complete the whole year for them, they will give you about maybe $4,000 to school for, you know, for your schooling. So that is some of those things I try to tackle within this time period, so I actually have myself ready for that time, like you said. Yeah.
Okay. As well. Do the other two want to? Do either of the other two ladies want to comment? Okay. All righty. No further questions, then, as soon as thank you again very much for your testimony and enlightening us a little bit. And is there anybody in the audience that wants to speak against the bill? Thank you very much, then.
All right.
Welcome. Ms. Smith, you just want to identify yourself.
My name is Stacey Smith with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. As a reminder, the Chamber of Commerce represents over 2,700 companies. We're the largest business advocacy organization in the state. And I feel that we are in support of any program like the Power of You, or this program exactly, or any other program that works on closing achievement gaps and aims dollars at students who need it in order to attain a college degree or any post-secondary degree. Our concern here is not about the program, again. Our concern here is about the funding mechanism, and that is that this money comes from the state grant program. It takes $4 million out of the Pell Grant, which is basically taking money out of the hands of students who need it and giving it to students who need it. It's not the way we should be funding this program. We should be looking at other ways to fund it. With that, I guess I'll conclude my remarks. But just to be clear, we do support this type of program. We've got, clearly, it's clear that our members are the ones that are funding it. So we support this type of thing. A lot of our members do. It is the way in which it's funded that we have concerns.
Well, Ms. Smith, maybe perhaps what you can do is we can have the chamber start a fundraising drive, and with some of your big hitters like Travelers, and I think Ms. Turner mentioned 3M or a few, really probably your biggest contributors to the Minnesota State Chamber of Commerce, you could start a campaign to create an endowment then with your private dollars and keep this program that's so worthwhile, even in your capacity representing the chamber here tonight, going, because I think some of your biggest members appreciate the program.
Mr. Chair, we actually, we do have a foundation, and a lot of these larger companies do have foundations, and these foundations have experts like this woman from Travelers that were here who are aware of all these programs, know the ins and outs, know what works, what doesn't, and can decide how they want to invest their dollars accordingly. So, yes, I agree with you. I think that is a great idea, and we've been working on this for a while.
Huh. Representative Carlson, you want to wrap it up? And we get to go home a half an hour earlier, even better. Is there anybody else that wants to testify against this? No? Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I may make a couple of quick points. It's not a statewide program, although I came this close at one time. It was actually agreed to in Conference Committee, and unfortunately didn't make its final passage to having it statewide when we had some revenue. You know, I've had an opportunity to have my hand in a lot of programs. I've been here for 36 years. I was on this committee, I calculated it, 26 years. And probably two of the most important initiatives that I've been involved in, when I chaired the Education Committee, I got the first funding for all-day kindergarten. And I'm talking about having a hand, like I say, in a lot of things. The other one that I haven't quite achieved, although to much to the credit of the people that got Power of Youth started, is this program, to open the doors of opportunity for high school students. I'm a retired high school teacher. I taught in a school that was 66% free and reduced lunch, 66% students of color. The counselors would come in and do an excellent job of explaining the various financial aid programs that were available. They would leave, and often those students would come up and they'd say, Mr. Carlson, we just don't have the financial resources, even with the financial aid, to attend college. And if you're a teacher in a classroom and you're talking to kids that have a lot of potential in their senior year, and they feel like they don't have that opportunity, let me tell you, your heart goes out to them. That's why I say this is a very important program. I used to comment when I was in the chair that you're in, Mr. Chairman, that if I ever had the opportunity, I would like to see that first year, maybe the first 2 years. In fact, I started looking at it, first 2 years free. And I had some very good staff with me, Doug Bird, Terry Fine was in the audience, and Nancy Connell was upstairs. And one day they set up a meeting with me, and I came over after school, and they said, Len, you've commented several times about if you had the opportunity, you'd like to provide that first year or two of college free. They said, we've got a plan for you. And the three of them outlined a plan, and that's the plan that almost made it into law. And it would have been every student in our public and our private institutions, by the way, at that time. It would. It did have a cap in terms of the amount that would have been available for a University of Minnesota student and a cap for the private colleges, but we would have opened those doors. So, Mr. Chairman, I would hope that this moves forward. I'm not taking any money away from the Pell Grant. You heard testimony that made it sound like it is. For those of you that have been following that issue, you know that the Pell Grants by the federal government were increased, and that freed up about $15 million in state dollars. So we don't touch the Pell Grant. Out of that $15 million in state dollars, the current law says that that money may be used for the living and miscellaneous allowance. I'm saying that $4 million could go into a program like this and open up the door for a lot of young people where that door just might not be open. So I would appreciate your support, Mr. Chairman. Those are my concluding comments.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. You've been around a long time, and I can't wait for the day for you to stand up on the floor and say, I've been in the legislature for 40 years, like Willard Munger. I'll just start off. So,
and
been
I
around.
Stand up on the floor to see a bill like this passed into law. Thank you.
Mr. Representative Welty then renews his motion that House File 3794 be recommended pass and held over for possible inclusion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Severson moves the minutes of yesterday's meeting. All those in favor signify any additions or corrections. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Members, tomorrow we'll be having the NIMSCU and university system in front of us to discuss the governor's grant and the Office of Higher Education. Meeting adjourned.